high desert and the great American Southwest. I bid you all good evening or good morning, as the case may be, and welcome to yet another edition of Coast to Coast AM. From the Hawaiian and Tahitian island chains, all the way eastward to the Caribbean and the U.S. Virgin Islands, south into South America, north to the pole, and worldwide on the internet, this is indeed Coast to Coast AM, and I'm Art Bell. Top of the morning. Tonight, Wayne Green. And what a treat you're in for. 73 Magazine's Wayne Green. He's been a ham radio operator in this life, maybe a previous life. We don't know. He will talk on many subjects, including cold fusion, ham radio, health subjects. Wayne Green will be all over the map, and I think you'll find him fascinating. Coming up in a moment. All right, a whole lot of shaking going on out there. Earthquakes, as you know, in California the last few days. Not big ones, but shakers. A short while ago, a 6.4 earthquake occurred in Argentina, and they seem to be now coming in on a regular basis. So again, I'm noting earthquakes seem to be a-swarming, for whatever that is worth. Now, instead of telling you about Wayne Green, I thought it might be interesting instead to let Wayne Green tell us about Wayne Green. He comes to us from Peterborough, New Hampshire. He's done a zillion things in his life. Wayne, why don't you tell everybody about yourself? Who is Wayne Green?
Well, I'm not sure people are that interested in Wayne Green, but I think they are interested in the things that I've managed to learn.
Nevertheless, Wayne, who are you?
Well, golly, let's see. I'm a native New Hampshireite. I'm born up in Littleton, New Hampshire. And I got interested in amateur radio early on, in my about 14 years old. And that has led to a lifetime of adventure for me.
Boy, it has been that, hasn't it?
Yeah. Because of my interest in amateur radio, I joined the Navy for World War II. You've read about that in the history books.
Sure.
And that got me into an electronic school, which is one of the best things that has happened to me in my lifetime. I think this is probably the only time in history that the government has ever done anything right. But the electronic school that the Navy had was superb. And from there, we had a lecture one day about how much fun it was in a submarine when I was in that electronic school, so I volunteered for submarines and spent the rest of the war on a submarine and had a lot of exciting adventures. And I've
always wanted to ask about that, if I can stop you for a second. What is it like in a submarine? It seems claustrophobic. It seems dangerous. When I watch movies that have to do with subs, it always shows them going down near crush depth, and you know the sounds coming from the sides of the hull and so forth.
Yeah, we've done that.
Oh, you've done that.
We came near to getting crushed at one time when the bow planes got stuck.
Mm.
We had been being chased on the surface. We'd used some new electric torpedoes, and unfortunately the torpedoes didn't work. So we had a beautiful target with three freighters right in a row. We sent six torpedoes out, and all of them went under the tankers.
Nevertheless, they noticed that you had fired them.
Oh yes, they knew where they came from, and they started. And the subchaser took out after it, and we went just as fast as we could on the surface. But they were catching up with us, so we dove. And since we've been going all ahead flank, the bow plane stuck.
Mm.
And I found out about it because my job was to run through the control room into the forward torpedo room up in the forward end of the submarine and lower the sound heads and then go back up into the conning tower and operate the sound equipment. So as I was running through the control room, I heard the man on the bow plane say, the bow planes are stuck. I can't get them off. Full dive. And I knew that wasn't a good situation. And so as I kept on running, I got up to the forward torpedo room, and I yelled at them up there to get off the torpedoes for a minute and get a pry bar and pry that pry the bow planes loose. So they quick ran over there and pried them loose. We were in what was called a 300-foot submarine. That was, it was designed to be safe to 300-foot depth. Well, we were going down around 400 feet by the time this happened.
Mm.
And everything was beginning to creak, and we got down to about 470 feet before we were going back up again. But if I hadn't just serendipitously happened to be running through and hear the problem, we wouldn't have made it.
So the movies are not wrong.
It is also interesting to sit there when you're being depth charged, and we got depth charged quite a lot. And some of the guys would get real nervous about that.
Some of the guys. Yeah, I'd be nervous about that. All right.
Well, my solution to that was to argue with them about how many depth charges it had been. Oh, no, that was 54, not 52. No, you're wrong. You know, and they get all embroiled in the argument and forget to be afraid.
Nevertheless, boy, scary stuff.
Well, it's exciting.
So that was World War II. And by the way, we're both hams, of course. Ham radio suffered a kind of a hiatus, didn't it, during the war?
No, it was turned off totally.
Hiatus, yeah.
I was on December 7th, 160 meters. As a matter of fact, that's where I heard that Pearl Harbor had been bombed. And it wasn't long before our ARL was on the air telling everybody to get off, that the bands were closed.
Exactly.
And then in 1945, when they opened them up again, I was on the first day, 2 meters. At that time, I was teaching electronics and radio at the submarine school up in New London, Connecticut. So I had a rig right there and immediately got on 2.5 meters.
Wow, that was pretty exotic for those days.
Right.
Listen, while we're on the subject of ham radio, I've got a AORL bulletin here in my hands, and it says, and you can tell me what this means because I'm not sure, a committee proposal for modifications to the FCC amateur licensing structure is to be published shortly in QST. Members will be invited to comment on their to their directors before May 31st of 97. The board will not take action on the committee recommendations earlier than the July meeting of the boards to afford members an opportunity for discussion and comment. What the hell does that mean? What are they getting ready to do?
Nothing of any moment, I assure you.
Well, the person who said,
wouldn't it be nice if they were going to propose that we no longer have to learn the Morse code?
Well, it doesn't.
The answer is yes, it would be nice, but it isn't going to happen.
That isn't going to happen. That isn't what is suggested here. As a matter of fact, quite to the contrary.
Now, we don't make people learn how to turn the crank on a car to get it started in order to get a driver's license anymore.
I'm with you on this, but this within ham radio, folks, is an incredibly contentious issue.
It's a religious issue.
Yeah, religious. That's right. Should a person have to learn?
I'm willing to tackle religious issues anytime.
I know you are. Should you have to learn Morse code to get a ham license is a basic question. Wayne says no, and I too.
I've been saying no for years.
I say no too, but it will bring out the religious, believe me.
Well, over half of the hams today have no code licenses.
Is that right?
Sure.
No,
we've had a drop in the number of licenses that have that require the code.
Well, it's going to lead me into another area. Is ham radio dying?
Yes.
That is. I think so, too.
It's dying because we turned off our input of youngsters. Amateur radio is one of the best things that could ever happen to a kid, because it makes it fun to learn new technology. And technology is where the world is going. So if you don't know about technology, you're kind of redundant these days.
Let me tell you, though, when things have changed, when I got into ham radio, I began, as I'm sure you did, very simply. I had a, you know, 6AG7 driving a 6L6, and that was it. Very simple stuff. A human being could work on it. I just recently got a new rig. I've got a Yaesu 1000 MP.
Mm-hmm.
If something went wrong with that, Wayne, I would no more go in there and try to fix that than the man in the moon.
Well, I wouldn't either anymore. And, yes, I spent years at the workbench building equipment.
Exactly.
I built an enormous amount of equipment down through the years. But we don't do that anymore. I'm reminded, early on, amateurs had to build their own receivers. And about the second day after the first commercial receiver came on the market, amateurs no longer built receivers.
Mm-hmm.
We had to build transmitters. Then after commercial transmitters came on the market, we no longer built transmitters, and so forth on through. I had to build all my first radio teletype equipment. But you don't do that anymore.
No.
And that's not the part of the hobby that it used to be.
And to be honest, technology has moved so far that it is way beyond the ability of the average amateur to tackle a problem in a very, very sophisticated computer-like transceiver.
Yes, but it is not beyond the amateur to get on to packet radio, to get on to slow scan, to get on to RTTY, and all of the different facets that we have.
That's
true. Have about 73 different hobbies. And, of course, the building hobby is one that is fading away. I still publish articles on simple construction projects in 73 magazine, and the readers love them. But, gee, there's just not that many people building anymore, and it's hard to get parts. You really have to buy kits of parts these days.
No, that's absolutely true. Nevertheless, people need to understand the upside of amateur radio, and we'll get to that in a moment. But in line with my question about is ham radio dying, on the Internet now, Wayne, there's something called iPhone. Are you familiar with that?
I'm pretty familiar with what's going on there.
All right, well, I, for example, can go on iPhone, and I can choose from just about any country in the world. As a matter of fact, when I first got it, I was so entranced, I talked to 50 countries in one weekend. Not just voice, but good color or black and white, depending on what kind of camera they have. Pictures as well. So, it's a video telephone over the Internet.
Right.
And in effect, it reminded me of ham radio, except it was, of course, without the fading, without the interference. It had so much clarity. You could see the person on the other
end. It didn't take quite as big an antenna.
And no antenna at all. People didn't use it from an apartment.
Sure.
Isn't that sort of going to be a replacement, in effect, a modern ham radio?
Yes, I think it is. And it does certainly provide an awful lot of fun.
Oh, it's a blast.
Sure.
It's a blast. I mean, I can talk to people in Moscow or communist China and have. And as I said, 50 countries, one weekend. You know, who cares what the sunspot cycle is doing? Doesn't make any difference. So, you know me, I'm an avid ham, and I just recently, by the way, got on 160 meters for the first time in my ham life. And I'm having a blast with that, too. But boy, Wayne, I see new technology coming along and replacing ham radio.
Oh, I do in every facet. The time was that if you needed emergency communications, amateur radio is about the only thing available. Now we have cellular telephones, and they seldom fail.
And so here we've got the Amateur Radio Relay League, your best friend, still saying, let's keep the code requirement. Let's keep ham radio dying a slow death.
Mm-hmm.
Why?
Okay, because it's run by a bunch of old men, that's why. I believe that amateur radio still has a very valid use and need in this in the world as a way to interest youngsters in communication and interest them in learning about electronics and communications, because it's fun to do. And it is fun to take a balloon out there and hang a television camera on it and send it up. It's fun to do all of these different things. And yes, of course, there are. We don't have to work as we call it, what we call DX, the hard way anymore. We can work it on the internet. But it's still fun to get on the air and talk to somebody over in Australia or somebody in China on 20 meters.
It is.
I enjoy doing that.
It is. Yes, you're right. It is. But
and then when I... Now, I don't know if the internet people are striking up, making it like a fraternity the way amateur radio is.
No, Wayne, it's closer to CB.
Yeah, that's too bad. Because the fraternity aspect of amateur radio is wonderful.
It
when I go to a foreign country, I'm greeted as a fraternity brother.
Yes, yes, I know. But it is, or was, a technical fraternity, and it slowly is dying off. Those who have the technical knowledge are slowly dying off. These days, everything is purchased. You go out and buy whatever it is you need. You might have to learn a little bit about antennas, but that's about it.
Well, you have to learn how to use it, too. And if you're going to go on slow-scan television, you've got to learn quite a lot. And if you're going to get on RTTY, radio teletype, you need to learn a lot. So it has its pluses and minuses.
Well, then, being bluntly honest, how do you see the future of ham radio?
I see a bleak future right now because the ARRL, our only national organization, and really it's kind of international because they run the international aspect of it too, because they have not figured out any good, valid reason for amateur radio to exist today. As I say, the only major benefit that I see that we could provide and quid pro quo for the frequencies we're using is a way of interesting youngsters in high-tech careers. Now, back before the ARRL proposed what was called, what they called incentive licensing, and that was 30 years ago. Back before they did that, amateur radio was growing at 11% per year,
right,
and 80% of all newcomers were teenagers. And we had a network of thousands of radio clubs and schools that were attracting youngsters and getting them into the hobby. And 80% of those youngsters went on to high-tech careers.
Mm-hmm.
So amateur radio was the major source for engineers, scientists, and technicians in this country.
Well, I have it to thank for my present career.
And me, too.
And so many of us, and it is, an, or at least was, and still to some degree is a fraternity. Jobs are offered and found through ham radio. Social contacts, very important, old boy networking.
You
that
bet.
That's a thing through ham radio. Absolutely
yep.
true.
Well, we stopped all that in 1964, when... It, with one stroke, the ARRL stopped the growth of amateur radio, went into a negative growth for several years, wiped out roughly 90% of the school radio clubs, wiped out 85% of all of the ham radio stores in the country, wiped out 95% of the manufacturers all in 2 years.
That's quite a stroke.
Yeah.
Quite a stroke.
And we've never recovered.
I was never so angry my whole life. I'd been on Okinawa. I was KR6BK. And I had all these privileges, and I came home, found out about incentive licensing, and almost went out of my mind. Wayne, hang tight. We're at the bottom of the hour. We'll be right back. Many, many things to talk about with Wayne Green. I'm Art Bell. This is CBC.
Art Bell is taking calls on the Wildcard Line at 702-727-1295. That's 702-727-1295. First-time callers can reach Art Bell at 702-727-1222. 702-727-1222. Now, here again, Art Bell.
Sally Ho. My guest is Wayne Green. We are going to cover many, many subjects, so stay tuned. All right, back now to New Hampshire and Wayne Green. Wayne, somebody during the break sent me a fax that spelled out in Morse code, boring.
Well, he's probably right. I think many of the listeners would prefer to hear things that will benefit them.
Yes, I understand. But just before we leave ham radio, and we will, it provided the nation with a pool of technically competent people. Where is that pool going to come from now?
Well, of course, that is the big problem. We have an educational system, pardon me, a school system in this country that is one of the worst in the world. We are not interesting our youngsters in high-tech careers. And when I go over to Japan and I go into the laboratories over there,
yes,
they're all hams. And they're, oh, W2NSD. Oh, yes. 73. Oh, yes.
Yes.
And everywhere I go, youngsters, every school in Japan has a radio club. And they have over twice as many radio amateurs as we have, with half our population. Is it any wonder that they're running circles around us?
Well, the question is why?
In electronics.
Yes, why? Well, okay, that answers it. But the question is, why are they able to get their youngsters involved and we're not?
Because they have the radio clubs in schools. Peer pressure.
So our school system, to some degree, is at fault. You're quite right.
To a large degree.
There was a ham club in my school, and that is what, I guess, ignited my interest. You're right. So
me too.
You're saying they're just not exposed.
That's right. Well, I give lectures at colleges quite a lot on entrepreneuring, and every time I ask, and I'm usually talking to the seniors, and I asked, and I said, well, now, how many of you are familiar with amateur radio? And maybe two or three hands will go up out of a couple hundred people.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, isn't it something like CB? They've never heard of it. And, you know, the idea of being able to sit down and just sit and talk with somebody, as we now can on the Internet, but been able to do this all my life, talk with people anywhere in the world. And, of course, it's led, as I said, to adventures. You know, I operated from the king's palace, sitting there with the king. I've operated from the embassy, American embassy in Tehran, the famous one.
Oh, yes.
The ambassador was a ham. I've operated from the DMZ in Korea and been able to walk into North Korea and so forth.
I always favored expeditions to islands myself, islands.
I've done that, too. Navassa Island down in the Caribbean, the desert island. I've been there twice on the expeditions and had a ball. I almost got killed, too.
Really? Listen, another topic, but related. There's a big brouhaha going on now in the courts and in the country about something called micro-broadcasting. Stephen Dunifer, Radio Free Berkeley, and that crowd, they're throwing transmitters on the air, on the AM and FM band, unlicensed, and they're broadcasting to people.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
I've been writing about this.
Have you?
Mm-hmm.
Good. I would like to ask you about your position on it. They claim freedom. First Amendment, the airwaves belong to everybody, that sort of thing, and they're just throwing transmitters on the air. So far, the FCC seems stymied. And,
well, isn't that tough?
So what do you see happening here?
Well, I'm all for it. I encourage it. The more voices we have out there, the better.
You always have been a troublemaker.
Yeah. Yep.
I'm afraid that I agree with you, but here's what I thought, Wayne. Instead of letting everything go willy-nilly into the present broadcast bands, AM and FM, since so much of shortwave, and even to some degree VHF, is going satellite, and it's freeing up some of these frequencies, why not allocate a new, this is my idea, a new AM band somewhere between the top of the present AM band and 3 megahertz, say, and a new FM band somewhere, I don't know, up above 6 meters below the present FM band someplace, and allow people to put on 10 or 20 watt commercial stations if they can manage to get somebody to sponsor them, and then we'll fire up a whole new industry selling new radios that could pick it up, and you'd have all these little individual neighborhood community broadcast stations, unlicensed, perhaps regulated only to the 7 deadly words or whatever.
Well, of course, the major drawback there is that you have how many 100 million radio receivers that won't receive them.
I know.
So it's a little difficult to consider going on the air with a transmitter that nobody's going to be able to hear.
Well, at least in the beginning, but everything has to have a beginning somewhere, and if we allow them to go in the present commercial bands, there is going to be some havoc.
You're going to have chaos.
Yes.
Well, I'm in favor of chaos.
You're in favor of chaos?
Yeah.
Well, you're presently on about 325 radio stations nationwide, and the owners of those are probably going, what the hell are they saying? So you're in favor of just let them go.
Yes, I think that what will happen, now, you know, nobody's going to fire up a micro-broadcast on a channel that has a good solid signal. They're going to look for places where there aren't any signals.
Right.
And I'm not sure that that causes an awful lot of harm. You know, in New York, it's useless to fire up on WOR. You know, why? You're not going to be heard, a quarter of a block.
That's correct, yes, of course.
Although I did like the idea that someone came on your program with the other night of pulling up alongside of a ghetto blaster.
I intend to consult with that person privately and tell him exactly how to do it. I thought that was a great idea. However,
one of the things that we talked about a year ago had to do with making money.
Yes.
And that apparently struck a chord with a lot of your listeners.
All right.
Because I pointed out, I said, we were talking about me living on a 200-acre farm up here in the mountains of New Hampshire.
Mm-hmm.
And you said, gee, that takes a lot of money. I said, well, my golly, it's easy to make money once you know the secret. And I think that there's a lot of interest in that because I immediately got thousands of letters, and I wish I was exaggerating.
Wanting to know the secret.
Wanting to know the secret.
How do you
know? So I sat down and wrote a booklet and said, okay, it's called Making Money, A Beginner's Guide. And very basically, it says this. If you're ever going to make much money, you're not going to do it working for someone else.
Right.
And I don't care whether it's a big corporation or a small company or anything else, you're not going to make much money or have much freedom if you're working for someone else. So what you want to do is have your own company. Now, that takes a lot of experience and training. There's a lot of things you want to know before you have your own company, and it's very expensive to learn on your own, and ridiculous to do that because you've got endless number of people who will pay you to learn and love to have it. And I'm going to write another booklet which essentially says, look, anybody who wants to get a job out there can get a job without a resume, without going to the newspapers and looking for help wanted, without going to an employment agency. There are millions of jobs available, but you have to make it. And what you do is you go to a small company in a field that you think would be a lot of fun to work with. And why work in something that isn't a lot of fun? That's ridiculous.
I agree.
So go to a company, a small company, maybe 5, 10, 15 people, and talk to the owner and say, look, you've got a lot of things you need to have done around here, and you got nobody to do them, and If I don't know how to do something, I will learn. And I'll do anything you want. I'll work half-time so you don't have to pay unemployment and all of those extra taxes and so forth. And just turn me loose. And you've got a job. And if you need to have full-time employment, you do it to two companies.
Well, I observe that you need an idea. You need to do something that other people are not doing. It needs to come along at the right time.
Well, if you work at this company and something that's fun for you, you will, first of all, learn the skills that you need to run your own company.
That's true.
With someone else paying you.
So you're talking entry level.
Entry level. Secondly, you will begin to understand where the needs are in that field for a new service or product. Because you're in it and you're immersed in it. And you'll know how to start your new business and what the product or service is going to be.
Good advice for a newcomer. But there's a lot of people out there, Wayne, that are 30, 40, even 50 or more. And they've been in careers, you know, work-a-day careers all their life, and they would like an opportunity to get the hell out, go do something themselves, and make a lot of money. Do they still have a chance? And if so, how do they do it?
Okay.
Not as easy. They've got mortgages and...
Oh,
you know.
Sure. So there they can't just drop everything and go to work. For the older people, what I recommend is you have learned some skills, hopefully, in working for other people, and you can certainly see where there is a need for some kind of a product, perhaps an information product, that you could start with in your spare time. And it's a better way to use your time than sitting there watching ball games. I highly recommend, if you're an expert in something, to start with a newsletter.
All right, let me tell you. I had a call yesterday. Actually, I've been in touch with this young man for some time, who listened to your program on my show some time ago and gave up what he was doing and began a newsletter called Prophecy Today. I'm going to give him an interview.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, when Wayne gets on tonight, be sure and thank him because I'm on my own.
Good deal.
So there you go.
Well, it is so simple to put out a newsletter these days. A used computer, and of course I prefer Macintosh.
Really?
And, but a used PowerBook, you know, is what, $300 or $400 these days?
I wouldn't know.
And a used laser printer is about the same price.
I prefer IBM.
Well, that's all right. No, it isn't.
I know.
The Mac is so much easier to use, so much more flexible.
Like the beta, Wayne. It's going like the beta.
I know. Been there. But at any rate, that's what I recommend, and it is so simple to turn out newsletters. My gosh, during the break here, I was on my computer adding some more books to my list of books that you're absolutely crazy if you don't read.
Adding more to the list?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, my latest booklet had 88 books that you're crazy if you don't read, and I just read a couple of more that are marvelous. And, for instance, one of the things that I'm very interested in is education, as you probably recall.
Yes.
And I've run across a school down here in Massachusetts that is absolutely knocking my eyes out here. It is called the Sudbury Valley School. Have you ever heard of that?
No, I have not.
Well, it is amazing. It takes kids from 4 years old on through 20, and they have no classrooms, they have no classes, they have no curriculum. the kids come in when they want, go when they want, and it is their responsibility for their education. The school makes anything available that they need, and if the group get together and say we want to learn mathematics, they set it up and have a class in mathematics every day for them. And they found that they could teach 8 years of mathematics in 20 hours. Because the kids are so anxious to learn.
Well, that's either a miracle or an indictment of the present system, and I suppose both.
It's both.
Yeah.
I have studied, well, of course, on my list of books that you're crazy if you don't read, I have a number of them which describe how terrible our school system is and why. and right on from the beginnings on through. One of the things, when children come along at 2, 3, 4, 5 years old, they have certain periods where they're supposed to learn certain things according to their normal development. Of course, everybody's a little bit different. And our school system puts everybody in lockstep. If you're 5 years old, you learn this. If you're 6 years old, you learn that, or else. And, of course, people don't work that way. And it makes it so that we end up with a population that is not motivated, is not creative.
Then how do you explain the Japanese that, if anything, are more structured than we are by a long shot, and yet they're turning out technically competent youth?
Well, if you take a look at what they're doing, they are not being creative about it. They are, every one of their major developments was started here in this country.
Oh, yeah.
Our creative people.
Yes.
And then they take them and hone them.
Make them practical and
right.
Market them properly, yes.
Right. So, we still have the edge on creativity, but we're doing our best to stop it.
Well, we sure do give it away, don't we?
Mm-hmm. At any rate, this Sudbury Valley School, I'm going to get down there and talk with them, but it certainly sounds fascinating to me. And they use, I think, a lot of the approaches of the Montessori schools, which are also excellent.
Mm-hmm.
The one thing that I think that they lack, and I've been on their case about this, is the taking of imagination of the kids. And that's P-I-Q-U, not P-E-A-K. So many of the letters I get from people misspell that. But at any rate, I made a list of the skills that I think that should be made available to kids when they're in school. And but again, I like the Sudbury Valley thing where you do it if you want. If you don't want, you don't do it. And because all of my life, the main things that I've learned have been because I wanted to and because I was interested, not because I was forced to. And I would say 98% of what I had in college is gone because I wasn't interested.
Mm-hmm.
And probably close to that through high school. So where you were forced to learn, and I felt like I was a slave because by law I had to go to school and I had to take these courses, and I wasn't interested.
How critical today is a college-level education to economic success in life?
I feel that it has no significance whatever. I think it's a waste of 4 years. If you are going to be a wage slave, if you're going to work for a job, then you need college for a larger company. A small company could care less. And the things that you learn in college are not going to be of much value to you for most work. Certainly, very little it has to do with being your own boss and having your own company. They don't teach you the skills that you need to be an entrepreneur.
No, they are teaching you how to work for somebody else, really.
Right. They teach you the things that will keep you in relevant poverty all your life. They teach you to work for a large corporation.
Mm-hmm.
They teach you to work for the government or the military. And none of those ever make much money.
No, you'll live, but you'll never get rich. You'll
That's
never
right.
be independent.
Yep.
And you're trying to tell people, regardless of their educational level, how they can become independent and how they can become wealthy, and you can do that.
That's right. And the educational level really has very little to do with it. unless, of course, you have learned not to learn. I read constantly. And I think any successful person, well, if you take a look at the people in Who's Who, they did a survey and they found they read an average of 20 books a year.
Mm-hmm.
They did a survey of teachers and they found that they read an average of one book a year.
That's amazing.
Now, I read about 2 or 3 books a week.
Teachers read an average of one book a year?
Right. fiction, usually.
That's amazing. What happens to them? They've been simply... What happens?
Well, if you read some of the books on my list, you'll find that the bottom 20% of the class are the ones that go into teachers' colleges. And after two or three generations of the bottom group going into that business, you have automatically selected not very good teachers.
All right. Wayne, hold on. We will be right back, and we will continue from this point. Wayne Green is here. Cold fusion ahead. AIDS cures, that sort of thing. Interested? Stay right where you are. I'm Art Bell.
Call Art Bell toll-free, west of the Rockies at 1-800-618-8255. 1-800-618-8255. East of the Rockies at 1-800-825-5033. 1-800-825-5033. This is the CBC Radio Network.
It is, and my guest is 73 Magazine's Wayne Green. He's been a rebel since he's been alive. And long ago, he published articles way back in the beginning about ham radio. Then he began to shift to computers, really making a lot of hams angry. And now his magazine is full of all kinds of things that many would consider to be ahead of their time. He's always been ahead of his time. But that's the way you get somewhere in the world, not by trudging along behind somebody else, in their footsteps. You create your own. That's how you make money. That's what we're talking about. He's got a list of books now, 80 plus, that you're absolutely crazy if you don't read. We'll talk about that in a moment. Back now to New Hampshire and Wayne Green. Wayne, how many books now on the list of books you're crazy if you don't read?
Well, let's see. It has 88 books, and I'm just about to add 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 more.
Wow. And this is a list you have compiled over what period of time?
A lifetime.
Lifetime.
Right.
And if you read these books...
Well, let me give you an example of a couple that are just going on.
All right.
One is called Sharks Don't Get Cancer. Have you heard that?
I certainly know about shark oil.
Well, this has to do with shark cartilage. And from what I can see from the book, if anybody has cancer or knows anybody with cancer, they have to be absolutely, totally crazy not to read this book.
What are the claims made? We're not making them. We're just passing them on.
Okay.
Will it actually, is it claimed?
Here's what it says. Here's what I say. This is written by Dr. William Lane. It said, Lane makes a very convincing case for shark cartilage being able to cure just about any cancer, as well as arthritis, psoriasis, and macular degeneration. As with any other non-pharmaceutical remedies, the medical industry has been fighting this as quackery. Lane points out how reactionary the industry is. Despite endless claims for the Heimlich maneuver for choking victims, the American Red Cross refused to accept it for 10 years, continuing to endorse backslapping, which causes the stuck object to be even tighter stuck in the throat. The money in the trillion-dollar medical industry, the most profitable industry in the U.S., is in drugs, which can be patented. So if an illness isn't to be cured with a drug, there is no organization to research the proposed cure. Well, you ask, how about the National Cancer Institute?
Mm-hmm.
Surely they'll check out any proposed cancer cure, right? Wrong-o. It turns out that the NCI, quote, does not deal in cures for cancer, but only in the mechanisms of cancer, unquote, and that's from NCI. Maybe that helps explain why so many reported cancer cures have been completely ignored by the NCI, and since about 50% of us are going to have a personal brush with cancer at some time in our lives, maybe we need to better educate ourselves and depend less religiously on our doctors.
Is this something that you would do only after you have become aware that you have some sort of cancer, or as a preventative measure?
I would recommend it as a preventative. Why? Why wait?
Why wait, huh?
I said, for heaven's sake, read the book. It could save your life.
All right.
Better yet, wait until you're almost dead from cancer or crippled with arthritis, and then spend the $12.
Now, this is not your book. You're just recommending it, right?
I don't sell the book. All I do is recommend it.
Fair enough.
I don't sell any of these books except two that are not available anywhere else. And that's the one about NASA mooned America, which makes a very good case for NASA having faked the whole
moon
landing
yep.
series. And since then, I've gotten a lot more response from readers who were involved with NASA and with other companies like that, saying, yes, we thought so at the time, and we didn't dare say so.
I want to talk to you about silver.
Okay.
There's a raging, raging controversy now in America about silver water.
Right.
What is the deal? Is it real? Is there any real documented benefit to it? The FDA looks like they're coming after it.
Well, one of the books on my list has to do with that by Dr. Faber, and it really is very enthusiastically supporting silver. The only negative that I've seen so far, and unfortunately this is from a very good source, this is Dr. William Douglas of Second Opinion, and I really have not found him off base yet, and he said that this is not a good thing. But every other source says, yes, this is a great thing, and so I'm trying to find out more. I tend to put out a booklet on it, but only after I've done the research and find out that either Dr. Douglas is right or he's wrong.
All right. Let's examine the claims. People are claiming that, is it colloidal?
Yes, colloidal silver.
Silver.
It's easy to make. My gosh, I've got a little glass here and I can whop it up in 5 minutes.
Right. It's claimed that in the body, it kills what?
Well, it kills virtually any microbes and so forth. And this is...
Viruses?
Yeah, viruses.
Viruses?
Yeah.
Even the AIDS virus?
Well, yes, I believe so. Now, I have not seen any documentation on that. There is a book that's on my list, going to be added to my list, called The Plague Makers by Dr. Jeffrey Fisher. And I found this at $4 at Barnes & Noble, marked down from 23.
Plague Makers?
The Plague Makers. And by Simon & Schuster. And it's explaining how we are creating catastrophic new epidemics. Doctors have been overusing antibiotics with the result that more and more germs and viruses have developed resistant strains. Take tuberculosis, for instance. It was almost eliminated. Now it's back and killing over 3 million people a year.
True.
Worse, we're using tons of antibiotics to stimulate growth in the animals we eat. Your supermarket doesn't tell you what you're getting along with your chicken and beef packages, and your doctor isn't going to tell you what great stuff like monkey virus SV40 you'll be getting along with those vaccines he's shooting into your arm or rump. Even if he knew, he wouldn't tell you.
Now, you're not the first one to tell me that.
Well, now, the silver colloid apparently is one of the answers to this. And as I say, I want to do more research before I put out a booklet on the subject.
Is it thought of then as a natural antibiotic? Is that the claim?
Yes. Yeah.
Do you think there is good substance to it? I understand you want to do more research. You seem more hesitant today about it than you have in the past.
Well, because of Dr. William Douglas, and as I say, here is a chap who puts out a newsletter called The Second Opinion,
mm-hmm.
and I have not found him wrong on other things. He is on board with dental amalgam being a deadly poison, with root canals being poison.
Really?
And, you know, and aspartame being a poison, NutraSweet, et cetera. And I agree with him on all of these things, even though he's way out in left field as far as much of the medical community is concerned.
All right, well then what is he saying about colloidal silver?
He says that silver is a toxic metal and should not be taken internally. And I've written to him about this several times, and I don't get the answer.
Hmm.
But I want to...
Would you?
I want to find out.
Would you?
Meanwhile, I am taking, I am putting some in my coffee every day.
You are. Okay. Well, that says a lot. I guess. With you. You're a believer until convinced otherwise.
Right.
All right. One of the things we've discussed on past shows, and we've got to discuss here, is this electric device that you have that you have claimed purifies the blood and can even take out the AIDS virus.
Well, this is based on the research done at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine in New York. And Dr. Cowley and Wyman discovered this apparently serendipitously. And they went out and got a patent on it. And I have the patent number around here somewhere. Anyway, I can give you the patent number on that, but what they do is take the blood out of the body, pass a little electric current, a very micro current through it, and put it back in the body again.
Mm-hmm.
And a friend of mine, Dr. Bob Beck, said, a physicist, said, well, you know, why take it out to do that when you can put a couple electrodes over your arteries, pass the current through the electrodes, and do it in vivo, do it in the body.
Sure.
So he came out with a little device for doing that. Since then, one of my readers of 73 Magazine developed a simpler device and less expensive, and I published an article on that last May called The Bioelectrifier. And the result of that is that I've been getting an increasing number of letters from people saying, thank you, thank you, thank you. So-and-so was cured of cancer, lupus, Lyme disease, herpes, etc. So I'm getting an awful lot of positive response on that. I've talked to Bob Beck, and he said that he has, and I have seen a sheaf of medical reports from laboratories of people who were just about totally out of T cells and recovered completely.
Now, what is the idea? In other words, how does this work? It passes a current. I believe we use it at the ankles, right?
That was originally. Now, I'm using it on the wrist, and in my booklet, I have a booklet on this that's available, and, which gives both Beck's original circuit and the Miller circuit that I published in 73.
Alright.
And they're very simple. They're available in kit form. They're even available from several sources in manufactured form, if you don't mind paying 10 times as much as the parts.
Right.
And, what you do is you have a very small electrode made with, say, a piece of number 10 wire with a little flannel wrapped around it and tied with a thread. And it's, you know, maybe an eighth of an inch in diameter and an inch long. And you strap this to your wrist and soak it in salt water first and use a an elastic wristband and stick it under there. And
sure.
Then turn up the voltage until you feel it throbbing. And the two arteries are about 3/4 of an inch apart on your wrist as you look at the palm of your hand.
Right.
And you can feel them there. And when you get the electrode just right, you feel it going thump, 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 thump as the voltage is reversed. And it reverses the voltage about 4 times a second. So
it's constantly reversing the polarity.
Yeah. And you run that about an hour a day. And it seems to, from all the reports, clean the heck out of the blood and get rid of any fungus, any yeast infections, viruses, microbes, etc. They're lurking in there.
All right. You've been you've had this out now for quite some time.
Mm-hmm.
How much anecdotal evidence is there? In other words, how much response have you had from people regarding whether it worked? And be honest, how much have you had saying it didn't do a thing?
I have not had, I don't recall anybody saying it hasn't done anything for them. the worst that happens is people say they feel a lot healthier. But anecdotally, as I said, I've had letters about cancer, quite a number of them, and that was an unexpected bonus. I believe that what's happening there is that the improvement of the immune system fights off the cancer, not the current in the blood itself.
Mm-hmm.
And we all know that the body is forming little cancers constantly. And unless we knock down the immune system takes care of them. That's what it's there for. So by rebuilding it, we're able to reverse a lot of those.
All right. There's also a fair body of evidence right now, Wayne, suggests that that there is a sort of a genetic trigger that when you get to a certain age, some little genetic switch gets thrown. And come what may, you are going to contract some form of cancer.
I don't think so. I think that, again, it requires a weakened immune system. And, of course, we're busy weakening that with Big Macs and fries and with aspartame and root canals and all kinds of things. We put poisons in our system, and we have stress which knocks down the immune system, et cetera.
Oh, yes. Well, but what is a body to do? I mean, you go to the, let's say you go to the dentist and you've got a tooth, that is in trouble. The dentist will tell you, we've got to save that tooth.
Right.
Now, I mean, you can pull that tooth.
But he doesn't tell you what the alternative is.
What is the alternative to root canal?
Pulling the tooth.
Yeah, right. Yanking it out.
Right. And, well, the other alternative is to leave it in there, and if you read the book by, was it Gamionis on root canals, you're going to have those teeth pulled out.
Why? What's the matter with the root canal than the fact that it's horrible to have done on it?
Meinig, Dr. George Meinig is the book on the root canal cover-up, it's
right.
called. And what he shows is that when they take a root canal tooth out later,
right.
they grind it up and rinse that with a little distilled water and then filter out the grindings. And if they can inject that into a rabbit, that rabbit will come down with the same illnesses that the person has. Arthritis, etc.
Well, yeah, I suppose the cellular genetic makeup would be present in that material.
Well, what happens is that your tooth is a whole bunch of very small, long cavities, the way it's designed.
Right.
And when it is a dead tooth, then these germs live in there and gradually seep into your system.
Hmm.
And he's got very good documentation on this.
All right, so root canals.
Bad deal.
Bad deal. Gee, I've had a bunch of them.
Yeah, I did too. Fortunately, I had a dentist that was so bad that I had that I lost all my teeth.
Uh-huh. So
he capped them all, and they all rotted.
So you consider yourself lucky?
In that respect, yes.
You know, you sent me a little list of... I guess before we get away from this, look, this bioelectric
that describes all about it.
Bioelectric
tells the history, et cetera.
All right. Every time we do a show like this, people say, oh, geez, I tried to get the address or the number for Wayne Green, and I missed it, and I really desperately need to know about the bioelectrifier. And I will tell you, Wayne, I've had a lot of good feedback on after shows we've done with regard to results on this. So how do they get that, or how do they get the list that you've got of the now 90-plus books that you're crazy if you don't read.
Okay, what you want to do is write to Wayne Green, Peterborough, New Hampshire, like in Peter Rabbit, and it doesn't seem to make any difference how you spell it. And the zip code is the magic thing, 03458. 345 is easy to remember.
Right.
You have to remember the 0 and the 8 on the other end.
So it's 03.
I get mail addressed to the Science Man, 03458. Wayne, 03458.
So in other words, they know you over there.
Well, I started the largest industries in town. You know, like Bike Magazine.
So they ought to know you.
Yeah. And I was president of the Chamber of Commerce and stuff like that. So they know me pretty well.
A lot of hams got really, really angry with you when you seemed to switch from ham radio as your focus to computers.
Oh, sure.
As your focus. They got really
before
angry.
That, they got mad at me when I started pushing repeaters.
Yeah.
And, I got the idea that hams really should enjoy repeaters, and I started publishing hundreds of articles on it. And the readers said, if you publish any more of those, we're going to cancel our subscription. And I said,
right.
You're wrong, and I kept doing it. Pretty soon I was getting letters saying, hey, this is the most fun we've ever had. And
well, that's how it works. As I said, you get nowhere by going in somebody else's footsteps.
Well, I did the same thing with computers.
I know, and we'll talk about that in a moment. Stay right there. This is CBC.
Taking calls on the Wild Card Line at 702-727-1295. That's 702-727-1295. First-time callers can reach Art Bell at 702-727-1222. 702-727-1222. Now, here again, Art Bell.
Once again, here I am. Now, back to New Hampshire and Wayne Green. Wayne, I'm going to read you a short fax I just got. Art, our radio club went out and bought 2 complete sets of ARRL study books with the intention of donating a set to each of the 2 high schools in town. To our shock, the librarians at one of the schools boxed up the books and sent them back with a letter on official school letterhead thanking us for our generosity and our good intention, but said the material was, quote, above the reading comprehension level of most of the students, and further, quote, had no discernible use in the educational future of the students. He signs it, you've got to be kidding, a ham in California.
Well, one of the things that I write in my editorials in 73 is, for goodness sakes, fellas, get out there and talk to the students in these schools. The schools generally will be very happy to have you come in and talk with the 5th and 6th graders, and these are the people that you want to get to. And I've been doing that, and with great success, and when I get through, they usually start a radio club. But for goodness sakes, get out there and let these kids know that amateur radio exists and what fun it is and the excitement that we have with it. For older people, yeah, it's a good hobby, because one thing, when you're a ham, you will never be lonely.
Right.
You always have someone to talk, and of course, I've had ham friends all my life. Last week, I was out skiing in Aspen, and a ham friend from Glenwood Springs came down to ski with me, or 2 of them did, actually, and this one fellow, you were advertising commodity purchasing, and
right.
What he does is provide commodity information by computer to the people that want to have the latest commodity information. He's made a wonderful business of it, starting out in the old TRF-80 days.
Well, as a matter of fact, here's another fact. Hey, Art, I disagree. The technical fields are now being filled with those who have been involved with computers. Ham radio is outdated. Computers, by far, prepare today's youth better for technical fields of today and the future This is where students, clubs, and curriculum are now focusing. While you can hear the world with ham radio, you can now hear and see the world with the Internet and multimedia. Chad in Honolulu.
Well, of course, I disagree with him on this basis. Computers will do all of that, but very few of the kids today are getting interested in what's in the computer and how to work with it.
Well, that's right.
They don't know how they work. They sit down and they work at the keyboard.
They play Doom.
And as a tool and play games and so forth.
Yeah,
right.
That's right. All right.
When you get interested in amateur radio, in order to get a license, you have to learn about the fundamentals of electricity.
Right.
And all of a sudden you find that, hey, this is a lot of fun. the next thing that you do is to hook your computer onto your ham rig.
That's right.
And work in packet. And you don't do this without knowing what's going on technically.
Well, that's true. You do get a basic knowledge. Now, here's somebody asking from Alaska, of all places, about your view of HARP, Project HARP. You know what HARP is.
Yes, I have editorialized on this. One of the things that I pointed out in my editorial was a comment by a good friend of mine, Fred Uniman, who has a book out called Raptures of the Deep, which I highly recommend. But at any rate, he pointed out that this has the potential, when they're blasting billions of watts of energy into the ionosphere, they don't know what's going to happen. And it has the potential for collapsing the ionosphere, which could collapse the atmosphere and create tidal waves and so forth worldwide.
Oh, my.
And, he may be wrong, but it has the potential for that.
So you have concerns about HARP?
Well, yes, I do. I can see very little positive and an awful lot of negative on it, and I think this is not a very happy thing, and people should learn more about that and read the book on it. Angels, please don't play this harp.
Right. Angels, don't play this harp.
Or don't play this harp.
Right.
Yeah, by Vegas.
Mm-hmm.
So, at any rate, it has the potential for creating an awful lot of difficulty.
Why do you think they're doing it? What ostensibly is claimed as the whole reason for HARP? I mean, why?
Well, what they want to do is create an artificial ionosphere so that they can wipe out communication by the enemy.
Great. Great. Now I don't exactly understand.
I'm not sure, are they going to do this to Libya or what? from Alaska? Sure.
I don't know. Anyway, I guess HARP is getting ready to crank up for some more here shortly.
I view that as another one of these scientist welfare programs, such as the space station and the super collider and so forth, and the hot fusion tokamak, etc. These are scientist welfare programs and have no real value for us foreseeably.
All right. Let's not talk about hot fusion, but cold fusion for a second.
Mm-hmm.
I've got an article here. It says, when Peter Hegelstein offered a theoretical explanation of cold fusion at this week's annual meeting of the American Society of Mechanical Engineers in San Francisco, he was apparently putting more on the line than his reputation. According to a recent article in the Boston Globe, he now faces a 10-year fight at MIT,
mm-hmm.
where his willingness to theorize about the controversial cold fusion phenomenon has raised apparently quite a few eyebrows. So he's going to go through John Mack did.
Right.
Because of cold fusion. Where do we stand with cold fusion?
Okay, where we stand, and I was just checking with some of the people in the field, we have the leading developer in this country of cold fusion is Jim Patterson down in Sarasota, Florida. And he already has six patents issued and has eight more that have been accepted and are expected to be issued shortly. That'll be 14 patents in this field.
Hmm.
What he has developed is a very simple approach, and he is selling research cells to companies like Bechtel, et cetera, that want to do research on this, for a fairly reasonable price, just a few thousand dollars per research cell.
Are you convinced it's real, Wayne?
Well, his cell that he's selling, which has microspheres of plastic coated with palladium and coated with nickel, and then he uses plain water, he has demonstrated that with 1 watt of power input, he's able to get 1,000 watts of heat out of that on a sustained basis. And be able to start and stop it at will. So, how does that sound to you, Art?
Sounds real.
Okay.
And he's
got patents on every aspect of it.
Patents, so it's been peer-reviewed. It's real.
Oh, yes. Latest issue of Cold Fusion Journal, which I publish, is 92 pages, and it is packed solid with information, both on the research development and on the theory behind it. And the leading theorist in the world is Hideo Kojima in Japan, who has the TNCF theory, and that is a neutron-catalyzed fusion, and he goes through all of the equations showing that all of these researchers are coming up with the information that fits into what's happening. And basically, it's a fairly simple process. Of course, it's what we know as alchemy, or transmutation of elements.
Mm-hmm.
And if you take, for instance, lithium and add hydrogen to it, you get beryllium. And then if you add hydrogen to that, you get boron. But you also have a very slight loss of mass in the process.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as soon as you lose mass, you multiply that according to Einstein's equation times C squared, and C is one humongous big number. And so that a little tiny bit of mass gives you an awful lot of energy or heat. What's happening.
Okay, there's a lot of heat, all right, and here we've got a professor at MIT facing a tenure battle over it.
We've had that before. Bachrist down at Texas A&M had the same problem down there when he claimed that this was going to be transmutation, and they said, that's impossible, come on, the Middle Ages, alchemy, etc., and they moved to have him lose his tenure.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like 24 professors ganged up against him. But this is the same thing that's been happening all through history. I don't believe the listeners can point to any major discovery in science or medicine that hasn't been fought by the establishment.
Oh, they react viciously.
Right.
Viciously.
There's one of the books that's going onto my list now. It's called Impure Science, Fraud, Compromise, and Political Influence in Scientific Research. And it's by Robert Bell. And
no kidding.
He explains why innovative ideas can no longer be researched, why research results can't be checked for fraud or accuracy, how fraud is vigorously covered up, et cetera, et cetera. You see, the journals in each of these scientific fields are peer-reviewed. Now, peer means equal, right?
Right.
Well, when you have a new technology, there are no peers.
You're exactly
right. There are no equals.
You're right.
And so what happens is that it gets refused.
And
therefore, it doesn't exist. It's no good. It's ridiculed. And they humiliate the people that are involved.
Well, that's to protect their own little egos and
exactly.
Careers and so forth and so on. Yes, oh, I'm very familiar with that. Listen, again, moving through the list, what are your theories? You say there's a lot of baloney in the media about Amelia Earhart.
Mm-hmm.
And there was some recent news about Amelia Earhart. They found something or another on an island.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
We've never talked about that. What about Amelia Earhart?
Well, I'll tell you what I know.
All right.
My father was in aviation. He designed and built the airport for Philadelphia back in 1928. And Amelia Earhart kept her plane at my father's field and occasionally came over to our house. And... I met an awful lot of the legends of the aviation field there. And from there, he went on to become passenger and cargo manager for Ludington Airlines. Well, now, the mechanic for Amelia's plane came by to visit us in 1937 and said that he was preparing her plane. And this is a fellow named Bob Wemple. And I've noticed he's been mentioned in a couple of the books about Amelia Earhart.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a good friend and had been over to dinner many times, so we knew him. And he was a small chap with his sandy hair and a waxed mustache, pointed mustache, and a cane and a limp and so forth. And he married Miss Philadelphia in a plane over Philadelphia. So, at any rate, he was the mechanic on this, and he was telling us that what he was doing was replacing the regular engines on the Electra with more powerful engines and extra wing tanks.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole purpose of the around-the-world trip was to take pictures of the Japanese Navy installations at Truk Island and to have a cover story. The regular plane engines and tanks would take them from Blaye, New Guinea, over to Howland Island. But with the added power and the added gas, they were able to fly from New Guinea up over Truk and then back over to Howland Island and in the same time, so that they would have a a cover story on that. Unfortunately, she did not find Howland Island. And
you're saying Amelia Earhart was...
She was a spy.
She was a spy.
Well, remember that she was a good friend of Franklin Roosevelt,
uh-huh.
And he had been the Secretary of the Navy, so he was well aware that the Navy was in desperate need of information on what the heck the Japanese were doing at Truk, at their major Navy installation there.
Well, you know, this is interesting. Before we get back to Amelia,
well,
because of the recent balloon...
Wait a minute.
You know about this balloon trip, right?
Wait a minute. Step two.
All right.
Wayne Green... at a submarine rest camp on Majuro Atoll in 1944, where several of my submarine buddies that were there at the rest camp talked with the natives, and they were telling about a plane that had crashed in the Marshall Islands 7 years previously with a woman pilot and a man navigator. The man got hurt in the crash. when they tried to land on the beach.
Mm-hmm.
And the Japanese came along a few days later, picked up the plane and the two people, and took them to Saipan. Now, I just happened to be there at that place. If you look at the map, you'll see that the logical thing to do if you miss Howland Island is to go northwest toward the Marshall Islands, because there's a lot of them and they're close together, and it's the only place where you're going to definitely, positively find an island.
Right.
So it made sense that that they could have done that. A fellow named Fred Gorner spent several years researching this and found out the same thing with the Navy fighting him every inch of the way, and reported it in his book about Amelia Earhart. So that's my input. This fellow, I had no reason to disbelieve him. As I say, we've known him for years, the mechanic.
Right.
Did this installation of the camera and the engines and the fuel tank.
Why nothing from the Japanese since?
Because apparently what happened was that just as the Americans were retaking Saipan, they killed her and buried her. And remember that she was an American spy, but she was also the most famous woman in the world. And so nobody wanted to admit that. The Americans didn't want to admit it, and the Japanese didn't want to admit it.
All right, flash forward now. The balloon trip that
mm-hmm.
just terminated, I think, in India or somewhere.
India, yep.
And... that balloonist was refused permission to overfly. I can't recall now.
Libya.
Libya was
right.
One and was...
At first, and then they recanted.
Then there was a second country that refused overflight, and because of that, he claimed he didn't have enough fuel.
Right.
Do you think that there could have been a similar concern on the part of those countries that wouldn't let him overfly?
Well, no. I don't think so. I think it's more bureaucracy than anything else. because these countries know that we are overflying with our satellites every day and able to get very clear pictures. The balloon would not add anything to our intelligence.
Okay. All right.
Okay.
I sort of wondered about that at the time. In other words, why would they refuse overflight on a mission of that sort unless they were worried about, I don't know, national secrets or something?
I think it's more bureaucracy than anything else.
Mm-hmm. All right. What I would like to do when we come back from the top of the hour here, if you can stay on, sounds like you might have a cold. Do you have a cold?
No, I have a little rasp in the throat, that's all.
Uh-huh. Well, my experience is little rasps in the throat turn out later to be colds.
I haven't had a cold in ages.
Really?
No.
And you attribute that to?
Well, I've been bioelectrifying myself for some time.
Oh, you have?
Oh, yeah.
So you use your own machine?
Oh, you bet.
Do you recommend it on a, not just a, for a specific ailment you might have, but as a general thing that you would do to keep your immune system up?
Absolutely.
Oh.
You know, what can you lose by having a powerful immune system? It bites off anything that comes along.
Anything at all, huh?
Sure.
How much success, anecdotally, is so far claimed with respect to AIDS in that machine, Wayne?
Well, the main information I have on that is from Beck, who has a whole sheaf of reports from laboratories of people who were tested before and after. And
what kind of numbers
I don't
are
think
about?
They're having very many failures.
Do you know what kind of numbers we're talking about?
Hundreds.
Hundreds. Anecdotally, albeit, but hundreds.
Right.
All right, Wayne, hang in there. We'll be right back. My guest is Wayne Greene. You're listening to the American CBC Radio Network. Stay right there.
Toll-free, west of the Rockies at 1-800-618-8255. 1-800-618-8255. East of the Rockies at 1-800-825-5033. 1-800-825-5033. This is the CDC Radio Network.
It sure is. Those are the numbers. Wayne Greene is here. If you have a question, come now. We'll go to the phone shortly. All right, back now to Wayne Greene in Peterborough, New Hampshire. Wayne?
Oh, yeah.
All right. If you get an opportunity, I've got a fax here asking from Eugene, Oregon, to please get the patent number for the blood purifier, if you can rummage in a break or something and find it. And then this. Dear Art, please ask Wayne if the bioelectrifier has been used and, in fact, did help any of the Gulf War veterans? And that's a very interesting question.
I have not had any information on that. I would be surprised if it wouldn't help, because from what I understand, particularly from reading a book by Dr. William Douglas of Second Opinion, most of the problems that the Gulf War veterans have had have stemmed from their inoculations that they got, particularly of unproven material.
Mm-hmm.
The patent number, by the way, is 5,188,738.
Okay, 5,188,738
for the patent on the
blood purifier.
Blood purifier.
Well, that's interesting. So there is an existing patent. Does that?
That was by the Albert Einstein College of Medicine, and the word that I have from a number of people is that they're denying it.
That they're
denying any knowledge of it.
Of what, the patent?
Right.
Well, yes, but it is or it is not. I mean, you've got the number.
Oh, the patent exists. I've seen copies of it, yes.
Uh-huh. How things get buried like this? I just...
Well, there's a book on my list here called Alternative Science. And, for instance, it points out that the Wright brothers' claim for heavier-than-air flight was called a hoax by the Scientific American.
Really?
Edison's crazy claims of having invented an electric light. All the scientists said it was totally impossible.
All right. We've got the equivalent of a giant ham set here, so let's go to it. And the phones.
Okay. Also, remember what happened when this Australian doctor came up with the crazy idea that a microbe was causing stomach ulcers. Helicobacter pylori.
Yes, yes.
And they fought him for years on that.
Yes. And
right?
All of a sudden now, mainstream science has embraced it, and they're treating people with ulcers now with antibiotics.
Right. Not until there was a big article in the New Yorker magazine.
Mm-hmm. First time caller line, you're on the air with Wayne Green. Hi.
Hello.
Hello.
Yeah, I wanted to make sure it was through. This is Dave in Seattle.
Hi, Dave.
I got a question for you, Wayne.
Yeah.
I was looking for some really interesting stuff. When I was a kid, I used to build crystal radios because I was bored, and man, I learned so much from that.
Sure.
I'm going to teach every one of my kids, or kill them, if they're going to learn how to build radios.
Well, I have a suggestion for you, Dave.
Yeah.
Get the material, have it sit around, and tell them, don't ever let me see you touching that.
That's it. You know, some of the
because if you try to force them, you're not going to get anywhere.
Right. Yeah, that's
no matter how enthusiastic you are, they're going to rebel.
You know, some of the stuff is I have a book here called Radio Receiver Projects by Homer Davidson, and it's a real and it gives 33 different radio projects, and I want to build them all. The problem is that there's two problems. It talks about all kinds of receivers, but I need some information on simple construction of broadcasters, and I also was looking for something, and I have a terrible time trying to find it. Remember the trench radios that were built during World War One? They get those little carborundum razor blades because they have the crystal.
Well, I don't remember World War One that well.
I don't think you're that old. But somebody somewhere has to have some information on how they were built, because if I could build something from the ground up, I'll start there. But,
well, it's certainly not difficult to build crystal radios. As a matter of fact, there is a Crystal Radio Society that puts out a wonderful newsletter, or a book, really a magazine.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been promoting that in 73 magazine. And they have marvelous crystal radio projects. Just their magazine is packed with them every issue.
Fantastic. Is there some way I can get a hold of your brochures and the
info
for the radio?
Lucky you asked.
Yes, here you go.
Right. You can write to Wayne Green at Peterborough, New Hampshire. And the magic number is the zip code 03458. I do have a couple of 800 numbers, which we have people at during 9 to 5 Eastern time. And if you want to write those down,
wait a minute. What are they, what are they for?
For getting information.
All right.
Getting a list of the various, I have copies of my editorials and stuff like that available.
All right.
800-677-8838. And if you didn't have a pencil handy, that was 800-677-8838.
Right.
And the other number is 800-274-7373.
7373.
Right.
All right. Now, you made an offer, I think, on the last program. If somebody would send you a self-addressed stamped envelope, you would send them a list of the now 90-plus books that you're crazy if you don't read.
Well, at that time, it was 49, and it wasn't too expensive. I've since put a price of $5 on that.
I see. $5, huh?
And, well, you see, that helps me buy more books. And your listeners have been just marvelous in writing back and saying, hey, try this one. Here's a book that you missed.
All right.
And so I have about 100 books backed up here that I've bought and that I'm reading as fast as I can that have been recommended by your listeners.
Okay. One other item that I want to cover before we go back to the phones is that the number one item you had on things that my listeners might be interested in would be your take on aliens, contactees, UFOs, the whole business. You say here, yes, they're real. Nothing else makes sense.
Okay.
What do you mean?
Let's think about it for a moment, if we can.
Sure.
Let's take a look at our progress over the last 50 years, over the last 100 years, and over the last 1,000 years.
Mm.
Now, I think we agree that there's a possibility, a probability, an almost inevitability that life is going to form in other solar systems.
There is recent proof. Oh, well, or even in our own.
Right. So, therefore, the likelihood is that civilizations are going to grow to the point where they can travel through space.
You bet.
And just looking at what we've done in the last 100 years, it is not beyond the stretch of the imagination to figure that we're going to somehow work a way of traveling not just to other planets, but to other solar systems in our galaxy, and possibly to other galaxies. We see hints that these things are possible. Well, now, if such a thing is ever going to be possible to us, then it is not likely, it is inevitable that other civilizations have done that probably 1 million years ago, 100 million years ago, and but certainly not right at our particular time. That's unlikely. And therefore, one of the first things we're going to do when we learn how to travel like that is to explore. And therefore, it is not just likely, but almost inevitable that Earth has been visited by these other civilizations in the past. And there's a book that made my list recently.
Oh.
By Horn, H-O-R-N. And, let's see, I have it right here. Humanity's Extraterrestrial Origins. And this Dr. Arthur Horn has done a marvelous amount of research into ancient documents. And he makes an awfully good case for aliens having been here and having, first of all, bioengineered people. And this would explain why we do not find that missing link.
In other words, at some point, there was a quantum leap.
Right. All of a sudden, we had people.
Yeah.
Where'd they come from? All of a sudden, we had another quantum leap from hunter-gatherers to farming. And that meant the domestication of crops, the domestication of animals. And it happened in a very short period of time. We had another quantum leap when suddenly we started having cities and towns.
Oh, yes.
And that called for another whole, paradigm shift.
That's right.
So he points out that the ancient documents support that beings from space were gods, and that we worshiped them and so forth, and that they came and went. And I think if we look at our present-day prayers, Our Father who art in heaven, well, why is heaven up there in space?
The only reason I can think that they...
There's more. I was just doing a little bit of background. When I was over in Sudan, I visited Omdurman. You ever hear of Omdurman?
No, sir.
Well, it's a town right across from the capital, Khartoum. And they had a museum there having to do with the Battle of Omdurman in 1898, where Sir Kitchener, Lord Kitchener, had a small group of British soldiers, and they had a fight with the Mahdi, the dervishes. And they had a battle of Omdurman. 48 of Kitchener's people were killed. Over 11,000 of the Mahdi were killed.
Mm.
Now, that was technology. They were fighting with spears, and Kitchener was fighting with Gatling guns, with dum-dum bullets.
That would do it.
and they wiped out over 11,000. So let's say that we have some visitors from other galaxies that have developed thousands of years before we did, or hundreds of thousands.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to be just as sitting ducks if there's any kind of a fight. So I view all of these space operas as just, you know, entertainment and having nothing to do with reality. The aliens have been here. I believe they are still here and are kind of pulling the strings behind the behind the curtain.
Well, that's where my question was headed. In other words, if they had, in effect, seeded life here,
mm-hmm.
Do you think they would be observing, you know, the Star Trek prime directive of not interfering, or that their interference would be invisible if it was there?
I think that the prudent thing would be to keep it invisible. Although we see, you know, when we see UFOs, it's not by accident. When we have contactees, such as reported by Mac, Streber, and so forth,
sure,
these are not by accident. One of the things we know pretty sure is that they must have some way of traveling through time. And the big indication of that is that when we see the flying saucer type of craft, we also see that inscribed on the walls over in France of the caves 17,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now, no civilization is going to make the same model of anything for 17,000 years.
Well, here's a question I've never asked you then, and I guess it's a natural. Wayne Green on time travel.
Right.
Time travel.
We don't understand it. We don't know how it can be, but it must exist. And we have plenty of hints. We have psychic people who have done a very good job of seeing things in the future. You have Damian Brinkley, who was shown future events.
Oh, yes.
And, you know, with a great deal of clarity.
Damian's a good friend.
Right. And if you recall, back in, 1976, he explained that we were going to have the Mideast War, who was going to be in it, and what was going to happen.
There is one great quote. Mm-hmm. If time travel is possible, then where are the time travelers?
Well, I think we're running into them frequently.
All right, Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Wayne Green. Hi.
Hi, this is Will, WTDY, Madison, Wisconsin. I have a question on ham radio. But Art and the gentleman might be, please will be aware that NPR, 4:20 p.m. today, had a nice news release on the big sunspot storm that happened January 6th and which caused the collapse of our atmosphere on the North Pole for a reasonable period of time. I would like to ask a question of this nice man. If for some reason, say, created or real emergency, the internet and other means of electronic old, non-old radio tube type communication gets shut down due to sunstorm or for some reason, or becomes too expensive or too overloaded,
yes,
and to prepare for such, then what is the reasonable lowest cost today in America to get amateur radio equipment for we the people to be able to speak to someone in Australia or Sweden on 20 meters? And what meter is best for long or short distance radio?
All right, well, that's a whole lot of questions. let's begin with, if you want to get into ham radio on the cheap today, what's it going to cost you?
Well, I would say, I would figure out about $1,000 to have a good station. That is, with a small tower, a good beam, a used transceiver, and a used amplifier for it. 20 meters is your best amateur radio long-distance band these days. And it will be for quite some time to come. As the sunspots increase, we will have more activity on the higher frequencies. But right now we're in a particularly low sunspot part of the cycle.
We are, and that's the next part of the question. It runs in 11-year cycles, and maybe you can correct me or help me, we have just passed the lowest part. I've heard that there's been a detected polarity shift in the spot that would indicate a new cycle has been
done.
Yeah,
the new cycle is starting, and fortunately, the new cycles always leap up fairly rapidly and then taper off slowly. So in the next probably 2 or 3 years, we will be seeing a good deal more of radioactivity on the higher frequencies.
So in other words, it's going to get better quickly.
It's going to get better.
All right, so that's good news for people who like listening to shortwave as well. All right, Wayne Green is my guest. And if you have questions, come now. We will be back in a moment. You're listening to the American CBC Radio Network, along with everything else. We're talking about my favorite subject, radio.
Taking calls on the Wildcard Line at 702-727-1295. That's 702-727-1295. First-time callers can reach our bell at 702-727-1222. 702-727-1222. Now, here again, Art Bell.
Wayne Green, who has been a rebel all his life, back again. Wayne, you there?
Yep, I'm still at it, too.
All right.
Matter of fact, just talking about what you're talking about there with the with Congress doing it to us again.
Yep.
When I was appointed by the governor to the Economic Development Commission of New Hampshire to see what we could do about getting New Hampshire out of the 1990-1991 recession, I did a lot of research, and I found that almost all of our serious problems that we have in this country, the deficit, welfare, drugs, and so forth, all stem from things that Congress has done. And so I have a proposed solution to that.
Really?
A simple solution.
What would that be?
It's called, if you remember back in the Roosevelt days, we had the National Recovery Act.
Oh, yes.
The NRA.
Yes.
Okay. I propose that we reinstitute that as never reelect anyone.
Well,
in other words,
that has merit.
Flush that toilet down in Washington and keep flushing it till we get rid of professional politicians.
There's a few things that stand in the way of that. Money.
Well, that is one of the reasons that we need to flush that toilet. Because money is buying Congress, and therefore we have large corporations and large interests that are pretty much calling the tune of what's going on in this country.
Yeah, but what prevents the toilet from being flushed is campaign money and incumbency. In other words, if you've got access to the media, as your opponent does not.
Oh, sure.
They're not going to flush toilet on you, at least better than 95% of the time.
If we can get the people to never reelect anyone,
yeah,
no matter what the premises are,
yes,
we will flush that toilet, both in the state and in the federal government.
Well, but how do you convince somebody in West Virginia, for example, not to reelect Senator Byrd, who consistently gets new roads and new projects and jobs?
Mm-hmm.
And lots of goodies. I mean, how do you do that, Wayne?
That is difficult to go against bribery.
And that's, yeah, that's really what it is.
That's what it is.
All right. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Wayne Green. Hi.
Stan from Chicago here?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, hey, guys, listen, I'm not bored at all tonight. Of course, I've been hand for 40 years. The question I have for your guest there is, just about the FCC. Are they ever going to start policing and enforcing their own rules?
No, they're not going to. They don't have any money for that, nor any inclination.
Oh, it's
remember,
a good
the
question.
FCC commissioners are appointed politically.
Right.
Okay.
But, you know, what's happening on the handbands now is a disgrace, I'll tell you.
I agree. And there used to be a day when the FCC would monitor the handbands, issue violations
right.
or notice of violations. And
well, that is now our responsibility. And if we don't do it, it isn't going to happen.
Yikes.
And if we complain about it, they will just shut us down. They haven't got the money to horse around with us. Remember, none of the reasons that amateur radio was given for its existence are valid anymore.
Yeah.
And we have no valid reason for having billions and billions of dollars worth of frequencies unless we come up with a new one, and which is what I've been proposing.
A new what?
A new reason for existence.
And and what would that be?
And that would be getting kids interested in amateur radio as a way to get them into high-tech careers. This is what worked for us up until 30 years ago.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's the old reason.
That's right. Well, that worked. And then we stopped that. And the other reasons that we had for having amateur radio were, number one was to provide trained people in time of war, and that was just fine for World War II, where 80% of the licensed amateurs went into the military.
Right.
And had a profound effect upon the war, because we won that war through technology. When I was on a submarine, we had radar, and we were able to go on the surface, right through a Japanese convoy, from beginning to end, and I knew where every ship in that convoy was and what they were doing, and they didn't even know we were there.
You know, it's interesting, Wayne. That was true during the Second World War. If you were a ham, boy, you went right into the Signal Corps somehow or another.
Right.
I thought that, and my parents thought that. And I went in during the Vietnam era.
Mm-hmm.
And I went in there, and I said, I'm a ham.
Right.
Did very well on all the testing and everything. And they said, okay, great, you're a medic. Thank you.
Right.
And I became a medic. So that,
well, they don't need us anymore for that, because everything is modular now.
Yeah.
And they don't do any servicing. They don't teach those things anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So, it doesn't take any brains to replace a module.
No, and ham radio is modular itself now. So in a lot of ways, it's very sad. And as you said, the outlook for ham radio long term is rather, at the moment, bleak. Unless we can figure out some new something.
Well, we figured it out. It's unless we can implement it.
Well, the ARRL, which I know is not very close to you, has not helped, has it?
They precipitated the worst disaster in the history of the hobby, which was their incentive licensing, where they came along and proposed a rule change, which devastated the hobby. And scared the heck out of everybody and put all of the virtually all of the manufacturers out of business and almost all of the retailers around the country.
Well, if Wayne Green, and you'd make a good czar, Wayne, if you were the ham radio czar and you could simply declare changes today, tomorrow, in ham radio, what would you declare?
Okay, what I would declare, I would have every ham club in the country make it their business to get into the schools and talk about amateur radio to the fifth and sixth graders and explain what fun they can have and how inexpensive it is to get started and what the benefits are. You know, why should they do that? And get them start poison their dirty little minds with amateur radio.
All right.
That's what I do.
First time caller line, you're on the air with Wayne Green. Hi.
Hi, I'm Ken in Santa Rosa.
Yes, sir.
Hi, how you doing?
Just fine.
Oh, good talk to you. It's the first time I've been on your show.
Well, welcome.
Good to hear you, Phil. I had two questions for you, Beth. One was, do you know about the Area 51?
Yes, I've read a good deal about it.
Maybe you can fill me in a little bit, because I kind of just got started with Art Bell, and I'm kind of the new kid on the block.
Well, Art Bell is out here next to Area 51.
Right, he's right next to it there. And what, there's a lot of mystery there, and not very many facts. So it would be just speculative. I've read an awful lot about it, and I'm not sure what I can believe and what I can't believe. So let's, you know, I don't think either Art or I can actually add anything really positive about that.
Okay, and then my next question was, I'm a ham radio operator also, and I have an HF station, and have you heard any of these strange signals that Art's been talking about? I tried tuning in a few times.
Yes. There have been a number of really, really odd signals, Wayne, in the 2 to 3 megahertz range, also in the 5 to 8 megahertz range.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm used to hearing, you know, I know Amtor and RIDI and all the various signals and what they sound like, and these are modulated in ways that I have never heard and incredibly strong. Have you had any reports?
No, I haven't heard anything like that yet.
Okay, well.
But for goodness sake, let's find out more about it. And if anybody out there knows, drop me a line, Wayne Green, Peterborough, New Hampshire.
The important zip code 03458.
Right.
All right. Wild Card Line, you're on the air with Wayne Green. Hello.
Hello, Art. This is Mr. White, Phoenix, Arizona.
Yes, sir.
Yes, a few points here real quick. I used to listen to this radio station in particular on Crystal Radio I built, and that's basically what started me listening to talk radio and making me so consumed by it.
Good for you.
Oh, it's terrible. I can't do anything about it. But the thing I wanted to talk to you, Ken, about specifically, if I do remember correctly, last time you were on the show, you were talking about some device that would cure people of AIDS. I think it was electric powered.
Yes, we've already talked about that tonight.
Oh, well, I just got in the door. Could you call
me? Well, send me your name and address, and I'll get you information.
03458?
Right.
Yep.
Okay.
All right. It basically purifies the blood. Wayne, is there going to be any laboratory-type testing, or is anybody looking into this scientifically?
I have been trying to get a friend of mine who runs a research hospital in Canada to do this. And he apparently has met so much resistance. Well, just remember what happened to Hagelstein down at MIT.
Yes.
With cold fusion. And remember also that MIT gets millions of dollars for hot fusion research.
so much for academic freedom.
Right. So it is difficult to break through this. The worst nightmare for the medical industry is an inexpensive cure for expensive illnesses. Remember, our whole medical industry is designed to take advantage of people being sick. They have no vested interest whatever in keeping you well.
In your list of things to talk about, it says, getting sick is not accidental. You do it to yourself.
Right. You do that through not having proper nutrients and by poisoning yourself. And I mentioned aspartame. I mentioned root canals. I mentioned dental amalgam as poisons. There are a number of others that we do. The body was designed over hundreds of thousands of years, maybe millions, to work on certain fuels. And we have changed those, and the body is not equipped to deal with that. One of the books on my list is by Dr. Bruno Combi called Maximize Immunity. And this doctor found that animals got sick when they ate cooked food.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, gee, I wonder if my patients will get better if they eat raw food. So he started feeding his patients raw food and was having cures of cancer, cures of AIDS, cures of almost every illness by switching people to totally raw food.
Japanese eat a lot of raw food.
You bet, and so do I. A wonderful combination is to take cauliflower, broccoli and carrots and put them in a Cuisinart and chop them up into about pieces about half the size of a pea.
Mm-hmm.
And then put on some sauce. And I eat several bowls of that a day. The sauce I make is a one I got from my grandmother. And it has yogurt and honey and apple cider vinegar as the primary ingredients and some celery seed in there for flavor. And wow, is that good. And So I eat mostly raw food, vegetables and fruits and so forth. But, of course, we have one more problem. And I think many of your listeners have probably heard the tape by Dr. Joel Wallach called Dead Doctors Don't Lie. And a wonderful tape. And he points out that the crops in our country are almost totally devoid of the minerals. They played out years ago. And you have to add roughly 90 minerals and nutrients to your diet if your body is going to get what it needs. And we need things like vanadium in small amounts and so forth, and selenium, et cetera, chromium. And he's got a book out called Rare Earths that is well worth reading. I've got to put that on my list.
All right. Your list is getting bigger and bigger.
And he has one also called Let's Play Doctor, which I use every day to answer questions from readers.
Quick switch of topics.
Mm-hmm.
The weather. The weather has been incredible for two hurricane seasons.
Mm-hmm.
It's been getting worse and worse and worse. The Northwest, once again, is being inundated. We're getting clobbered. Even here in the Southwest Desert, we're getting clobbered.
Right.
And
have you read the book, The Survival of Civilization, by Hamaker?
No.
Okay. Well, I guess I'll have to put that on my list. I just read it a few days ago. And he says that this is exactly what's going to happen, and he explains why. And a lot of this, or I should say virtually all of this, comes back to the demineralization of our soil, which has harmed the growth of trees, and this is worldwide, has harmed the growth of trees and crops, and made it so that the CO2 is increasing in our atmosphere. So what he proposes is that you grind up rocks and spread it out and remineralize the soil, and in tests when they do that, it is just amazing what happens. Just in, you know, adding a little bit of rock mineral to feed for steers increases their weight by 38% in an actual test, and cut their food supply, cut the amount of food they ate by 31%, and so forth. So he makes an awfully good case for it. And that's, the book is called The Survival of Civilization, and he has three problems threatening our existence. And this is by John Hamaker, H-A-M-A-K-E-R. And, And I guess that's going to go on my list.
All right. Nevertheless, new ice age a possibility. In other words, are the changes that are underway perhaps irreversible? I know you can crush rocks and throw them out, but it may be too late for that, and we may have a basic change.
And we may not have the will to do it. Remember, we have been so totally robbed of initiative and motivation by our school system that we just sit there and let it happen to us. We've let our government happen to us.
Mm-hmm. All right, east of the Rockies, you're on the air with Wayne Green. Hello.
Morning.
Good morning. Where are you?
Calling from Winnipeg, Canada.
Yes, sir.
I heard you talk earlier in regards to newsletters, and I'm in the midst of putting one together, more of a newsletter slash booklet.
Good deal. Send me a copy.
Okay. What I wanted to know is, the way I'm thinking of generating revenue is through the sale of ad space. Any suggestions as to another possible way?
All right, well, it's the old conundrum. In other words, you've got to have readers before you can sell ads. How do you answer that, Wayne? As you're trying to get a newsletter together...
Well, I have started 25 different publications that have been successful, so I know the route.
All right.
To start a magazine, it takes about $500,000 up front to get it started, and up to enough readers so that it will support the advertising that you need. For a newsletter, yes, you can sell ads, but again, as Art points out, you have to have the readers to attract the advertisers.
Mm-hmm.
Also, you want to be in a fairly narrow niche and provide a way to reach the readers that those advertisers cannot reach in any other way. So we're not talking about General Mills here. We're talking about specialized products. And there you have a good advantage on that.
So,
does that make sense?
So in other words, pick a topic that is relatively narrow, one you are personally interested in.
Right. Well, of course, you have to do that for your newsletter anyway.
Sure.
If you're just going to put out a health newsletter, you're in there with 8,000 others. And, you know, what are you offering that's different? Well, you have to have some specific thing that you're an expert on and that you're enthusiastic and that is fun for you and that isn't covered by somebody else. Make sense?
Absolutely, yes. Listen, we're coming toward the top of another hour, and I know you've got a bit of a sore throat. Do you want to stay around for another hour?
Be alive for another hour.
You'll be alive for another hour. All right, quick call then. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Wayne Green. Hi.
Yeah, good morning. This is Dave in Kansas City.
Hi, Dave.
And I just wanted to, Wayne must be right on track because I've disagreed with him about half the time and agreed with him about half the time, so he must be right in the middle.
Well, you haven't done your homework, or we'd be in total agreement.
Oh, yeah, right. If I ever totally agree with you, I think I'll quit. And envy you with your FT-1000.
Oh, well, thank you.
And you're just a little bit younger than I, and I've been a ham for 36 years. One of the things I thought might be of interest is the amount of geographical knowledge and news knowledge you can get off of ham radio.
Yeah.
For instance, at 3:40 yesterday morning in the Kansas City area, there was two pieces of space debris that landed and were still on fire on the ground in the local news media that occurred.
Really?
So, through the years, you find out all kinds of things like that. I'm listening to you guys on KCMO 810 here in Kansas City and listening to the Heard Island D Expedition in the other ear. And that can be kind of interesting and teach you some geography. I've learned a lot of geography in the last 36 years.
I love going on D Expeditions.
He's right. Thank you, caller. He's right about the geography. That has helped me. I mean, you sit and you talk to somebody on some island, and you've got to know where the hell they are. So you get out the globe or the atlas, and you begin looking, and you find out where they are.
You ask a ham where Spratly Island is, and he'll tell you.
There you go. All right, Wayne, hold on. We'll be right back to you. My guest is 73 Magazine's Wayne Green. He's a rebel, but so are we. We'll be back.
West of the Rockies at 1-800-618-8255. 1-800-618-8255. East of the Rockies at 1-800-825-5033. 1-800-825-5033. This is the CBC Radio Network.
That's what it is. Good morning, everybody. Wayne Green is my guest. Always fascinating. Nearly any topic, technical or otherwise, he'll take it on. So, if you have questions, get on the phone. Back all the way to New Hampshire, where morning is closing in quickly. And Wayne Green. Wayne, a fax here. This is Ron from Nashville, Tennessee. Tonight on the local news, they reported that we had 50 to 100 mile per hour winds during thunderstorms earlier this morning. They reported these winds were caused by two factors. One, the thunderstorm clouds collapsing on themselves downward, and two, the jet stream very near the ground. And I've had some people in the past predicting the jet stream literally coming down on deck, and there have been quite a number of reports, not just this one, but on the West Coast as well, getting extraordinary winds, and you hear the weather guy say the jet stream literally just about came down to the ground. Now, the jet stream is, I don't know a whole lot about it, Wayne, but I know it's supposed to be up there, not on the ground.
Yeah.
This is exactly what Dr. Hamaker was predicting in his 1982 book. He predicted this was going to be happening and explained why. So, any rate.
So
it's happening, just on schedule.
Great.
Actually, it's a little behind. He thought it would happen by 1990, and here it is, 1996.
Mm-hmm. First time caller line, you're on the air with Wayne Green. Hi.
Hi, this is Steve from San Diego.
Yes, sir.
I wanted to ask Wayne about his publication, Cold Fusion Magazine.
Yeah.
In issue number 16, you had an article there, Electrodynamic Cold Fusion.
Mm-hmm.
Did you recall the speed of the electrons in that energy ball, the green energy ball?
Well, the speed, of course, varies in the energy ball because
yeah.
It is a has a vortex in the center.
Right.
And your it isn't electrons,
exactly.
The energy, whatever it is, and we
yeah.
don't know what energy
yeah,
is.
Yeah, it's one-tenth the speed of light, okay?
Okay.
And that's the same thing Art's been talking about because he talked about the green energy ball over Seattle.
Right.
At
well, anyway,
it
is spinning around in this kind of a ball like a ball of yarn.
Mm-hmm.
Goes about seven times around, then down through the center, and of course that speeds it up in a vortex, just like a we have with a tornado. And so it gives you a wide band of frequencies in this that is difficult to measure. But that's apparently is what the very fundamental particles that matter is made of, and I've written about this in the publication, and I kind of felt that I was getting way out on a limb because this publication is read by many of the top physicists in the world,
mm-hmm.
and here I am, an editor up in New Hampshire, trying to tell them what matter is made of, but of course. I got the idea from one of the books on my list by Phillips having to do with occult chemistry and work that was done 100 years ago and published on how matter is made up.
Well, at least,
and so forth.
At least they can't take you in front of a board and challenge your tenure, Wayne.
Well, I have had a lot of positive on this, and nobody has taken me to task yet, and I was very surprised by that. Because this is very presumptuous. I'm not a physicist.
Here's a crazy idea. Somebody called the last few days and said that they believe it's possible to, I know it's going to sound crazy, but blow up a tornado. And,
mm-hmm.
and that a fighter aircraft or that some other type of aircraft could literally fire something at a tornado and blow it up. And the more I thought about it, the more I thought, well, maybe you could.
You know, this energy in a tornado is equal to how many atom bombs?
That would be...
There's a lot of energy in a tornado.
Yeah, but I wonder how much it would take to just simply disrupt that magic little flow that has to occur for a tornado to form. It's an interesting idea.
Yeah, I think that is something that Wilhelm Reich was working on with his orgone, and of course they arrested him, destroyed his laboratory and all of his equipment, and put him in prison where he kind of mysteriously died.
Wild card line, you're on the air with Wayne Green. Hi.
Hi, Art.
I can barely hear you there, dear. You're going to have to scream at us. Where are you?
I'm in Las Vegas.
All right.
Is that better?
That's better.
Okay. I was a little concerned when Mr. Green was talking about the sarcartilage.
Mm-hmm.
I believe it's a very promising product. I have done research on it. I am a registered nurse. One of the things I find to be confusing is the dosage. It takes a relatively high dose.
Yes, it does take a very... I noticed that the cartilage capsules that I have approximately 3/4 of a gram, and the book recommends 20, 30 grams a day.
Yes.
So I would run through a container of 60 capsules in 2 days.
Right. So it gets very expensive. And
well,
the thing is,
I'm not sure. For both of you, let me add something. I've got a fact here. It says, number one, there has been no proof that shark cartilage does anything for cancer. Number two, it is beginning to result in a terrible shortage of sharks.
No,
No.
None of those are true, Tart. The studies Dr. Lane originally had done in Puerto Rico, because it was the only place he could find where the doctors were willing to actually do the studies. In fact, I have the studies. And what he did was he took the sickest people that were the closest to death. That those were the only people that the Cuban government would allow them to work with.
Mm-hmm.
They gave them 30 to 60 grams a day of sart cartilage, and several recovered completely. A couple did die, but the majority of them did recover and show no signs of.
All right, so you both agree then that there is benefit.
Yeah, that's documented in the book quite well.
Yeah,
as far as the shark shortage is concerned, we lose more sharks to the tuna fishers than are being lost any other way.
All right.
The sharks that he uses now, he has a company. His sharks are bred specifically for this purpose, so that they're not depleting the supply.
All right. Good enough. Interesting, very interesting. And I can tell you, if I had terminal cancer, you can bet I'd be out there shopping for cartilage.
Well, you'd certainly read the book, and you'd read the Dr. Combe book, too. Otherwise, yeah. My gosh. I wanted to cover one other thing. You mentioned, longevity.
Yeah.
And I mentioned a few of the poisons. I didn't mention chlorine in the water. I didn't mention fluoride in the water. I didn't mention the poisons that we put in through immunization shots, air pollution, and sugar and white flour. Now, the things that I add to my diet are flaxseed oil, garlic, and I take about a tablespoon of garlic a day, chopped garlic a day, a teaspoon of cayenne every day, extra minerals, vitamins A, C, and E, and I make sure to get ultraviolet light into my eyes when I go out for my daily walk, without glasses and so forth. And there's a wonderful book on that by, Dr. William Douglas on the need for getting ultraviolet into your eyes, which we don't in the car and with dark glasses and through the glass in our houses and so forth.
Let me ask you about the sun generally, Wayne. I have been doing this program for 13 years, an all-night show.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm like a bat, an owl. I'm out at night and generally sleeping during the day, and I rarely see the sun.
Mm-hmm.
Bad news?
Bad news. It is not going to help you. Either get sun or get ultraviolet. And for goodness sakes, read the Dr. Douglas book on it. Wonderful book on it.
All right. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Wayne Green. Where are you, please?
I'm in Casper, Wyoming.
All right. Go right ahead.
Okay. Wayne was talking about getting the young people into amateur radio, and I would love that. I've been a ham for 43 years, taught code and theory classes for about 20. But at the present time, with the no code people moving in from another radio service,
CB, you just say it, sir. CB, right?
Yeah, CB.
Yep, CB.
And when the father says, you talk to the father about the kids getting interested at 12, 13, he says, I don't want my sons associating with that kind of people, and hangs up. And other people say that since you got the people from 19 in there, I don't want any part of it. We had a group of about 40 club members, and now we got about 10 or 15 ex-CBers got it.
They don't want the youngsters to talk to people 19 years old?
They don't want to talk to people from Channel 19.
Oh, yes, right.
And
I can understand that.
Yeah.
However, if I were just getting interested in communication, the first place I'd go would be CB, and then I would find that limiting and want to look for further fields, and that's when I would get into amateur radio if I was hearing about it.
I'll tell you, Wayne, I love ham radio, because it's been a big part of my whole life, but I see it dying.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm very sad about that. Hopefully, the bands will hold out, during the rest of my lifetime, but I'll bet you, before my life is over, I will see the majority of them auctioned off.
Oh, I agree, and I think that's going to happen during my lifetime. I'm 74. I'm planning on living another 30 years, and I think 15 of those will be without most of our bands.
Very sad. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Wayne Green. Hi.
Hi, Eric. Hey, Wayne.
Yeah.
Great conversation. Say, I have two questions here. The first one was I wanted to know how I could get a list of your books there. It sounds really interesting.
Wayne Green, Peterborough, New Hampshire, 03458.
03458?
Right.
Right, it's $5, right, Wayne?
Yeah. Well, no, the list of stuff that I have is free. That's a 12-page list.
Oh, really? It's free? So yeah. What do they do? Send a self-addressed stamp envelope, that kind of thing?
Oh, just send me a call in on the 800 number or drop me a line, and I'll send you the booklet.
All right.
12-page booklet listing all of the different things that I have. Because I've got reprints of my editorials, and I have a book of my World War II submarine adventures, a 96-page book. And I have a couple of books of my travels on the expeditions and so forth and things like that. And one of a hunting safari is in the works, and I'll have that out shortly, where three of us went over to Africa and shot everything that moved and had a wonderful trip over there. That I got into that because of a ham in Kenya talked me into it.
Communication,
at least. All right, so anyway, the list is a freebie.
All right. But let me give the 800 numbers again.
All right, please, go ahead.
They're open 9 to 5 here Eastern Time. 800-274-7373. That's the easiest to remember.
Mm-hmm.
800-274-7373. If that's busy, try 800-677-8838. 677-8838. And if my past appearances on this show are any indication, they're going to be busy.
Yeah, they're going to be busy. That's right.
I got over 10,000 letters as a result of being on here. Right?
Wow. That's a lot of reading.
Well, that's a lot of, and I appreciate it, particularly people who take some time to write and don't just say, send me a list, but say, you know, tell me a little bit about themselves.
Sure. All right, back to it, east of the Rockies. You're on the air with Wayne Green in New Hampshire. Hello.
Hi, I'm Mike from San Antonio, Texas.
Yes, sir.
Back in January of 1959, Martin Marietta Corporation had an electric system for nuclear auxiliary power. They used polonium 210 data in transit satellites, and they produced 2,900 watts hours of electricity over 280 days. This thing is only 4 3/4 inches diameter and 5.5 inches high. Now, they also use something called strontium titanate.
Mm-hmm.
Melting point was beyond 3,000 degrees Fahrenheit. Now, I was curious. You mentioned, Mr. Green mentioned that in Japan, he had something that was used 1 watt that was...
Well, that's America.
That's
Jim Patterson down in Sarasota, Florida. It's known as Clean Energy Technology Incorporated, CETI.
Uh-huh.
And they put on demonstration at the power show in Los Angeles a unit that was required 1 watt of drive and was giving 1,000 watts of heat, measured by a calorimeter right there.
What about the guy in Japan? Did he use polonium?
The guy in Japan is a theoretician.
Oh.
And he explained why this is working and gave all of the equations, which are in my issue 20 of Cold Fusion Journal.
Okay.
Another fellow in Japan, Yabauchi, has done remarkable work in photomicrographs of the cells after they've been used, showing the miniature explosions that are taking place, or micro-explosions. Because what they're doing is generating heat into the millions of degrees and causing transmutation of elements through, like, kind of a miniature tokamak.
Wayne, how many significant inventions for mankind, and when I say significant, I mean, the kind of machines you're talking about that generate more than you put in, that sort of thing. How many of those sorts of inventions have been developed and then utterly, totally suppressed?
I don't know. I know of a number that have been, said to do that, and I have not been able to confirm that they really do.
Difficult to separate mythology.
The closest one is the Takahashi scooter, which I personally have ridden. I went over to England, over to London, and got on it and drove it around, and something magical is happening there. I don't understand how a motor made with magnets can generate more energy than it takes, than you put in.
I never heard of this thing, so what is it?
Well, it's a motor made with very powerful magnets. Takahashi has a patent on the magnets, and I have some of them here, and they are remarkably powerful. And Takahashi has a very legitimate background. He's the fellow who worked for Sony and developed the Trinitron and did much of the development work on the Sony Walkman and so forth, and has made some major inventions. He's got patents on a capacitor that about 1 inch square will have one farad of capacity.
Wow.
Yes.
Wow. I want to hear more about this scooter, too, so hold on. We're at the bottom of the hour. My guest is 73 Magazine's Wayne Green. Really saying that does not do justice to what he has done. Byte Magazine, he's had so many magazines, so many publications on so many topics. He's a rebel, and he's here this morning. He's Wayne Green. I'm Art Bell, and this is the American CBC Radio Network.
Taking calls on the wildcard line at 702-727-1295. That's 702-727-1295. First-time callers can reach Art Bell at 702-727-1222. 702-727-1222. Now, here again, Art Bell.
Once again, here I am. Wayne Green will be with us for the entire period. So, if you have questions, come ahead. All right, back now to Wayne Green, 73 Magazine's Wayne Green.
Hiya.
And, Wayne, here we go again. There's a lot of people who want to talk to you. So, let us begin. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Wayne Green. Hi there. Where are you, please?
I'm in Dana Point, California.
Okay.
Wayne, my name is Brett, and I've been fascinated by the subject of the blood purifier this evening, and I'm interested if this is applicable to pets.
Huh.
Oh, yes. Absolutely.
Blood is blood, I guess.
Blood is blood, sure.
Okay, you were talking about the electrodes, and I'm just curious. I wanted to ask about how I could get a hold of one and what the cost would be.
All right, those are good questions.
Yes, they're selling commercially for about $200 for the unit. The
that's
parts, if you want to build it yourself, cost under $19. And I have in my booklet, I have a list of the parts with the parts numbers from Mouser Electronics and so forth.
That's for people like us, Wayne. Most people aren't going to build it. They're going
to shame on them.
Yeah, well. I
know. It's a grief. By the time I was 15, I could build anything that I could see the circuit board.
All right. But let's face facts. A lot of people these days, particularly people who are ill, aren't going to be able to build it.
They're going to have to pay more, that's
yeah.
all.
Yeah.
But, you know, a couple $100 for cleaning out the blood, that's cheaper than going to the doctor and getting poisoned.
All right. So what route do you suggest for them if they want to buy one of these machines?
What they need to do is get in touch with me, and I'll give them an 800 number to call.
All right. All right, that's good. And the way to get in touch with you, I don't want to be terribly redundant here, but if not, the network's going to get swamped with your number. So let's give out your 800 numbers, please.
Okay, the 800 numbers are 274-7373.
And?
And 677-8838. Or just drop a note to Wayne Green, Peterborough, New Hampshire, 03458.
That's Peterborough. Peter,
that's right.
Peter
but
Burrow.
you wouldn't believe the spellings that I get.
Yes, I would. Yeah, I live in Pahrump, Nevada. You ought to see what they put down for that. First time caller line. You're on the air with Wayne Green. Hello.
Hello, gentlemen. How are you?
Fine. Where are you, sir?
In Los Angeles.
All right.
I have a question. Actually, it's twofold for Wayne. Number one, about 3 years ago, I took an interest in ham radio. And so I took my first test, the technician class test, and I passed that. The next week, I decided to go on, and I took the general, passed that. Then the next week, I took the advanced, and the next week, I took the extra, and I passed them all with flying colors. Then I came to the Morse code. That's where I ran into the problem. I found that I was a little dyslexic, so I went to a doctor who...
Dyslexic schmexic.
Yeah, right.
What you need to do is use my code course. I have... Look, it's so easy to learn the code that it's pathetic.
Well, you tell me how, because not only that, Wayne, I have a mental block. I say,
I know, and I have a solution.
No need anymore.
All right, well, listen, he's got a solution. Go ahead, Wayne.
Right. What you have to recognize is that the normal way of learning the code is to memorize what the characters are. B is da did it did it and so forth.
Right.
And then you listen to it and you hear da did it and you say, oh yes, B. You look it up in your mind just as the computer would looking up a table, right? Well, unfortunately, you get up to the operating speed of the brain, which is about 10 words a minute. And it won't go any further.
I could have done it in 5 words a minute.
Right. Well, so what you do is start out at the speed you want to learn. Let's say it's 13 words a minute.
Right.
And you listen to the code at 13 words a minute, and when you hear a dit go by, you write down an E. And when you keep doing that until it becomes automatic. And every time there's a dit, you write down an E. Then you listen, and when a dit goes by, you write down an I. And you train yourself, just as you would in playing the piano or a guitar or any other instrument, you train it so that your fingers do what you hear without thinking. And when you learn the code this way, and you just expand it to one character after another, when you learn the code this way, you can sit there and copy the code while somebody is talking to you, and you're talking to somebody else and not even listening to the code.
So do you have your tape?
Yeah, I have tapes available for that, and it's on my list of stuff that I send out. I have a booklet also on how to pass the 5-word-a-minute code test with less than 1 hour of study.
You're kidding me.
No, I'm not kidding.
And this is, I can find this in your...
You'll find this in my list of stuff that Wayne puts out.
All right.
The second question is real quick. The ARRL, you were talking about the fact that it was composed of a lot of old-timers that just don't want to get rid of that code because of the fact that they've had to learn it. And
exactly.
They feel that anyone that doesn't know the code is...
And never mind that it's out of date.
Is there now this output out of Dallas, are they in competition with ARRL? Is there any way that they can take over what ARRL has?
No, all they're doing is putting out a newsletter which has an awful lot of bums open it, plus they have a bunch of examiners that they feed information to.
Mm.
But they have no organization.
It's a funny thing with me and the code. I got a license when I was almost 13, and I've been consistently licensed ever since. And the code, Wayne, came so easily to me. I mean, to this day, and I haven't touched a key in I don't know how long, I can copy 20 words a minute, no sweat.
Mm-hmm.
But you know what? I hate it. I hate it. It's a prehistoric, slow mode of communication, and I know I'll get a lot of nasty letters, and I don't care.
I don't hate it, but I don't like it either, and the main reason I know is because I was forced to do it. And I will do anything people ask me, but if they tell me I have to do it, they can just go plumb to someplace.
Yeah. And warm up.
Same thing goes for our beloved government.
I just somehow didn't like it, and yet it came easily to me.
Sure.
Weird. Wild Card Line, you're on the air with Wayne Green. Hi.
Hi, this is Norman from Kansas City.
Yes, sir.
And, answer my first question. Yeah, the code is still, you still got to learn the code.
Yeah.
But, I was kind of wondering,
make it easy, that's all.
My another question is, I'm kind of like, I know electronics 101 and 102, you know, up to start to get digital. I was wondering if I'd like to start building, like, kits, stuff like that. Small receivers and transceivers and stuff like that.
You'll have a ball.
Yeah.
Building kits is so much fun that it shouldn't be allowed.
Yeah, whatever happened to Heath kits?
Bad management.
I mean, where do you get kits anymore?
Oh, Ramsey is turning out kits. MFJ is turning out kits. Ramsey's kits are marvelous.
Are they?
Yeah, and he's selling a ton of them.
Doggone it, Heath Kit still ought to be here. That makes me angry. I grew up with Heath Kit. I built so many of those damn things. I spent hours and hours and hours and hours. The first Heath Kit that I ever built, Wayne, was, the AR-3 receiver.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, I had very little electronic instruction, and nobody told me that you were supposed to cut leads. And so I put in all the resistors and the capacitors with a full lead length.
Right.
And it was horrible. I mean,
right.
When I got done with this thing, I turned it over, and I put it down on the table, and it smushed everything inside, and the whole thing went up in smoke.
Sure.
East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Wayne Green. Hello.
Hello, how you doing?
All right. Where are you?
I'm in Alabama, sir.
All right.
Mr. Green, how you doing?
So far, so good. Can you stump me?
No, I don't know, sir. I want to ask a question. I've been going to doctor over 40 years, and nobody seemed to help me with the problem I have. And I heard you tonight say that shock cartridge may be what I'm looking for. I'm going to have a macular degeneration.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just...
I would run, not walk, or whatever you can do to get the book. I was lucky. My wife found it in a used clothing store out in Aspen.
What's the book?
It's called... was it Sharks Don't Get Cancer by Dr. Lane.
Okay, it's on his list, caller.
It's on my new list.
Okay, can I order it?
Yeah, you can get
not
the list.
Not from me, no.
Not
I don't sell the books on my list.
Yeah.
Okay, the Shark Cox, will you help me here?
Sharks Don't Get Cancer by Dr. Lane, L-A-N-E.
What did you say about Shark Cox?
Can you go to a... you know, a bookstore?
Oh, sure. Barnes & Noble and so forth should be able to order it.
Okay, would it be okay if I took the shark cartilage?
That's up to you. I'm not a doctor.
That's right. We don't give medical advice, caller.
All I'm saying, this is information that I've found that looks awfully good.
All right. First time caller line, you are on the air with Wayne Green. Hello, where are you, please?
I'm in Tacoma, Washington.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I had a quick thing back to colloidal minerals. Wayne, I've seen so much controversy over where the best source of these things is.
I haven't found it yet either. I'm suspicious of some of them because they don't take out the toxic minerals.
Right.
And I know you need to have about 90 minerals, and I don't know a good source yet.
Yeah, Dr. Colloidal Rocks, they claim to be ground up ancient vegetation.
Yeah, but that also has a lot of toxic metals in it that they don't take out.
And then other vendors claim that it is just soaking a hunk of shale in some water or something.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, I have heard from a number of people that are taking the toddies and swear by it.
All right, there's also a lot of controversy about the dosage. And a lot of people claim that this very low dosage stuff you can get by producing it electrically is insufficient to do what needs to be done. Do you agree with that? Wayne?
I think that's probably true. One of the things that I wish someone would do, and I wish I had time to do it, is find out what dosage we need of all of these 90 minerals and start making them colloidally and make a little cocktail that will give you the things that are missing from our soil. In the meantime, I did mention the book, The Survival of Civilization, and in there they point out that you can grind up the stone and just eat a teaspoon of stone every day, and that will give you most of the minerals you need.
Mm-hmm. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Wayne Green. Where are you calling from, please?
Mount Holly, North Carolina.
All right. Welcome.
Hey, what is the polarization for the antenna on ATV on 420 megahertz?
Your choice, really. I think generally it's your choice, really. I mean, if you want to work mobiles, for example, Wayne, you'd use vertical polarization.
Sure, but for ATV, probably what I would do is use the cross polarization so that I can switch.
Yeah. Okay, I just found it. I was
from the home location.
Jen, I don't want to get too technical, but generally vertical polarization will deliver to you more noise than you want. Horizontal will eliminate some of that.
Yeah. I just found it on my VCR down below 14 by accident.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
You found some hams down there, did you?
Yeah. Oh, well, I knew they were on there, but I didn't know they had TV until about a year ago.
Oh, we've got thousands of hams on TV.
You bet.
And they're having a ball with it.
And I think ham radio is going to make a big comeback if people get tired of paying their cellular bill.
That may well be. But I think it's wishful thinking. We need something startlingly new for ham radio. And
we used to do all of the development and inventing of new technologies.
Right.
And once we got killed 30 years ago, we pretty well stopped doing that. But up until then, we invented and pioneered narrowband FM, which is all that's used on VHF these days. We invented single sideband, which is what's used for shortwave communications.
Oh, listen, here's a way to jump into the middle of a good controversy. On 75 meters, this is for the hams out there, single sideband is the preferred mode. But there are a lot of people clinging to or reviving AM and using up massive amounts of spectrum at 75 meters. What do you say about that?
If they were allowed to use Spark, they'd be back on with Spark.
I guess that's the answer. So, in other words, you think it really ought to be banned?
Well, maybe narrowband Spark.
East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Wayne Green. Hello.
Hi, good morning, sir. How are you?
Where are you?
I'm in Tennessee. This is Dwight in Tennessee.
Yes, sir.
Good morning, Mr. Green.
Howdy.
How are you, sir?
Well, so far so good. Try and stop me.
Okay. I'm a ham operator also. I guess you're getting a lot of calls tonight about that. And what have you heard about the proposal that they've come up with about limiting us to 50 watts on ATF here in the next year or so?
Oh, yes, the big environmental brouhaha going on. Cut hams down to 50 watts and have environmental studies mandated for powers above that and all that baloney.
That's it. You got the right word there. Baloney.
Baloney.
Yeah.
Is it going to go through?
I don't think so, although just because something is baloney has never prevented the government from doing it before.
Well, I'll tell you what, they'll rip my linear out of my cold, dead fingers.
I think that we're probably going to have the same situation. That is, they'll be still have the 1,000-watt, 50-watt stations.
West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Wayne Green. Hello.
Hi, Wayne. This is Pete in Portland.
Yes, Pete.
Before I get to my question, I'd like to mention Stanford Ovshinsky, the inventor of those pinkish-purplish little solar cells in every cheap little calculator in the world. And he invented that when physicists told him he couldn't.
Exactly. And I wrote to him and said, look, if you want to make Ovonics popular, you need a publication. And he never answered me.
That's too bad. But he's got a going concern. First of all, two questions. the cap that you were going to design for us that would shield us from the evil influences of HARP.
Mm-hmm.
Some kind of a cap that would sit over our brains to keep them from being addled at 7 hertz. Have you come up with that? Have you published
No.
it?
Are you in need, Pete?
There's one more thing. About 4 years ago, there was supposedly a mathematical paper submitted for peer review that proved, supposedly, that there is no such thing and cannot be any such thing as a set of random numbers. You can't count things in nature like radioactive decay of atoms and get a random sequence. It's impossible. And I don't remember the man's name, the mathematician who proposed it, and it just kind of disappeared after that.
I have a feeling you're getting into chaos theory there.
Could be.
Right. So I know that with computers, random numbers are virtually impossible because computers are just too automatic. But and they can make it so that they have a long time between the repetition, but it eventually repeats.
Oh, that's interesting.
Chaos theory tells us that we can have random numbers, but that they all kind of fall into a pattern eventually.
Fascinating. All right, east of the Rockies, you're on the air with Wayne Green. Hello.
Hello.
Yes, sir, where are you?
Liberty, Missouri.
All right.
I just wanted to ask you one thing. Where was he at the end of the war?
Where was I at?
Yes. I was at the submarine base in Connecticut.
Oh,
teaching electronics and radio. I got off the submarine just before the last run, and when they made the last run, they didn't quite get on station when the war was over.
I see.
All right.
Well, I was at Saipan on the submarine Orion, submarine tender.
Tender, right. I've been on the Orion.
Have you?
Oh,
that's
sure.
Squadron 16 out there.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, the Orion was responsible for sinking an awful lot of submarines.
Yep.
All right, sir, thank you. Wayne, hold on. We'll be back to you after the top of the hour. Relax. One problem with the Internet, and there is one, is that a lot of people don't have it, and we're constantly referencing photographs that we put on the website. And, by the way, we've got a new bulletin board up there, www.artbell.com. But not everybody has the Internet. So how do you see the photographs? The answer is very simple. The Art Bell After Dark newsletter. Newsletter, here you go. I suggest anybody out there who wants to see all of the things that we talk about night after night, call the following number and order our newsletter. It's unlike any other you've ever seen because it deals with topics, you know, the kind of thing we talk about here that's out on the edge all the time, which is where I like to be. So to get the newsletter, Art Bell After Dark, call 1-800-917-4278. Come on, take that number down. Actually, you can call it right now. That's 1-800-917-4278 for the Art Bell After Dark newsletter. Wayne Green's coming back. Stay right there.
Of the Rockies at 1-800-618-8255. 1-800-618-8255. East of the Rockies at 1-800-825-5033. 1-800-825-5033. This is the CBC Radio Network.
By the way, Wayne, have you ever heard of or seen a Levitron?
No, I haven't, but I've seen some things similar to that where, you see, we don't understand much about magnetism.
That's right. They are amazing.
This is a field that people could pioneer now. We don't even know what a magnetic field is.
That's true.
We don't, you know, we just don't understand this. We don't know why it works or how it works, but we can use it.
Mm-hmm. All right, another subject. Somebody said you forgot to mention in the kit world, Tentec apparently now sells some kits as
you
well.
You bet. Now, they have some nice stuff.
Uh-huh.
Oh, getting back to magnets just for a moment.
Sure.
I saw a video of a demonstration where they had a large jar of water, and they had a surface tension meter on it.
Right.
And they had people come up and put their hands next to it, and nothing much happened. And then they put a magnet next to it, and the surface tension of the water went way down.
Oh, my.
They then had a psychic come up and put her hands next to it, and the surface tension went way down. They then showed a video taken a week later when the psychic was back home, about 1,000 miles away. And they called her up and said, you know, we'd like to run the experiment and see if you can lower the surface tension. So she said, fine, and they had the video camera on during all of this. And nothing happened for about a minute, and then all of a sudden, the surface tension plunged. And she called back, and she says, I apologize for the delay, but you have the unit in a different room, and I had to find it.
Oh, that's amazing.
So, and I've seen the video on this.
All right, this is from Chicago. We're jumping around now because we're trying to cover so many things we have covered. With regard to your electronic device and blood purifying,
mm-hmm.
Ask Wayne, does the yeast or the fungi and general waste, where does it go after the electrons kill it off? Does it stick to arterial walls? That's from Chicago.
As far as I know, it's eliminated along with the other waste products by our lymph system. By the way, just in line with that, I have a little note here on my booklet that said several decades ago, there is a very well documented record of an old man being struck by lightning and surviving. He proceeded to grow a third set of teeth, a bushy new head of dark hair.
Really?
His inoperable cancers disappeared, and he no longer needed his glasses, his cane, and was completely healthy.
This is not a reason for the average citizen to go fly a kite in a thunderstorm.
No, no. This is an anomaly. But every time there's an anomaly, we say, how in the heck did that happen? How can we replicate it?
Yeah, by the way.
Any number of cases, down in the Amazon, the natives, whenever they get bit by a snake, take a wire from their spark plug on their boat and zap themselves with it, and it counteracts the poison. And the pilots that fly down there have a little generator that generates a high voltage in case of snake bite.
That's amazing. And again, that goes really back to your device in a way.
Right.
All right. Art and Wayne, you may know this person, Wayne, with respect to the demise of ham radio, that old geezer that called in complaining about CB has got to me. I'm a former 73 writer for 23 years and a longtime friend of Wayne. In my Looking West column, I often wrote that if CBers really had any interest in ham radio, they wouldn't bother to get licenses. They'd simply buy radios, put up antennas, take over the ham bands by sheer numbers. CB has been around for a long time, and it's rare to find CBers invading our bands. It does happen once in a while, but not often. With this in mind, I kind of doubt if there are very many Channel 19 types on our VHF bands. Why should they get a ham license to talk across town when they can talk around the world on 11 meters? The problem I see is the superiority complexes of hams over the rest of society, and the combined with our kids running off to the World Wide Web instead of 2 meters or 40 meters is what the real problem is. The World Wide Web portion of this sad situation will be covered in the Newsline report I am editing as I listen to this program. It'll be online in 12 hours. Ask Wayne if he does not agree, and feel free. You can use my name, Bill Pasternak.
I knew that was Bill Pasinac.
There you go. That's who it is.
I've known him for, you know, like 35 years or so. Yes, a couple of items I'd like to comment on. First of all, CB has been maligned, and I think very unfairly. I operated CB for quite a long time because it was fun, and I did not run into any of the bad things that I've heard about on CB anywhere that I went. And every time I traveled to any new city, I always took a CB rig with me for my rental car so that I could find my way around and get help.
Right.
I never had any problems, never heard any bad language, never ran into difficulties. Now, I've heard tapes that have been sent to me, so I know that bad things do happen.
Oh, yes, but they do on 2 meters,
my
too.
Experience was very good with CB, and I enjoyed it. And I found, actually, CBers usually were more helpful than hams when I had problems.
Try listening to the 2 meter band down in L.A.
Well, that's always been bad, Art. That has been a cesspool for 40 years.
Yeah. And one other thing he says here that does require, I think, addressing is the superiority complexes of hams.
A few, sure. And we have no intelligence test and no sanity test that we give with a ham license. So we have a good cross-section of intelligence and insanity.
Would you offer yourself up as an example?
Yes, I think I can offer myself as an example of insane. Sure.
All right, first time caller line, you're on the air with Wayne Green. Hi.
Hi, how are you today?
All right, where are you, dear?
Des Moines, Iowa.
Des Moines, Iowa. Good. Welcome.
Well, this is the first time I've ever listened to your program, and I don't even know who you guys are, so I feel very ignorant at this point.
It doesn't matter.
Okay, I know he's not a doctor, but you were talking about shark cartilage and stuff like that, and I was just wondering if you've ever heard anything about a disease called alopecia areata.
I'd have to look it up in my Joel Wallach book on Let's Play Doctor.
Okay, well, quick synopsis is, your girl, your hair falls out, you're bald. And I've gone to holistic doctors and stuff like that, because I'm from L.A. originally, and I moved here. But I was just wondering, do you know of any, like you said, that guy got struck by lightning, now he has a full head of black hair?
The fellow Bob Beck that came up with the approach of putting electrodes on the body to pass the electric current through, this son of a gun has grown a whole new head of hair.
I'm thinking I'm hoping
he's old.
Lightning.
And he's grown a whole new head of hair.
In his 60s.
Wow.
And he had male pattern baldness, and he's grown a whole new head of hair. I asked him how he did it, and he said, well, he takes the silver colloid and sprays it on his head, and then he takes his lymph blaster, which is a coil of wire in series with a photo flash unit. That's also described in my booklet.
Mm-hmm.
And he blasts himself about 10 times with that, a couple times a day, on the head. And, he is sporting a completely new head of hair.
Is that painful?
No, you don't feel a thing. You don't feel it. I've been doing it to myself here, and I haven't felt a thing.
And are you
but
grown
I just
hair?
Started, so I haven't grown any hair yet.
Oh, okay.
All right, well, right away, get his list and go from there. I mean, read. That's the answer, read. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Wayne Green. Hi.
Hi.
Where are you?
I'm in Long Beach, California.
All right. Yes, sir.
My name is Joel.
Yes.
And today I went out and bought a 9-volt battery and stuck two wires connected to the 9-volt battery to a nickel and a penny. And I found that the penny eroded and fell to the bottom of the glass of water.
What the significance is of that.
Pardon?
What's the significance of that?
Well, I remember from...
we said to use two nickels.
Oh, two nickels.
Two nickels.
I thought it was a nickel. I thought it was a nickel and a penny.
No.
Two nickels.
Right.
It's the double nickel test, and it's described in a couple of issues of Cold Fusion Journal.
Oh.
All right.
By a fellow named William Ogle.
All right, don't be so cheap. Use two nickels.
Right.
All right?
I mentioned that on your program before, and several people have written saying, yes, that works. As a matter of fact, I think the second time I was on, somebody called in and said, yes, it worked.
And the water will boil after about 2 or 3 days.
Well, that's irrelevant. It'll boil anyway. What you want to find out is if you're getting more heat out of the system than the electricity you're putting in.
Right. Than what you put in. With
yeah, right. You need to have a thermometer in there to measure the
right.
temperature in the glass versus the temperature outside.
All right?
Right.
Give it a try. Report back. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Wayne Green. Hi.
Morning.
Good morning.
My name is Devin. I'm in Fremont, Nebraska.
Hi, Devin.
And call from work, so let's make this quick. I just had a question about the electric blood purifier.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. I understand you're not a doctor and you're not making the claims, but is there a problem with the, isn't there a blood-brain barrier that might pose a problem with that as far as AIDS viruses and other?
No, I don't think so. What that recommends is first that you purify the blood as much as you can. And by the way, I've had a letter from one chap that says, well, I didn't bother with all that. I just put the 3 9-volt batteries in series and used a couple of electrodes and just periodically touched my arteries with them and didn't have to build any apparatus. And he said he's already seeing results. But, what was the question?
As far as the blood-brain barrier?
Oh, yeah. First of all, you want to clean out the blood.
Mm-hmm.
Then the problem is that the HIV virus in particular and others harbor in the lymph glands and gradually come out and over a period of years. So what Beck proposed on that was to make a coil of wire, about 150 turns of number 14 wire, on about a 2-inch coil. And just kind of jumble wound, and put that in series with a photo flash gun. And by the way, Beck is the fellow that has the original patents on photo flash guns. And this gives a very sharp shot of electricity through the coil and generates a very high magnetic field. And he put that up next to the lymph glands, and that blasts the virus out of the lymph glands. And
then
so
you kind of
do that until you feel logy, and then you don't do it anymore until the blood is cleared again.
Hmm. Okay. Well, it's great listening on the phone. We don't get you here after 5 o'clock. Sometimes I can get you on St. Paul. But...
Well, kick him in the shins.
Yeah, I'll have to give him a call. So.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Have a good morning. First-time callers, area 702-727-1222. No, last name.
Oh, excuse me.
No last name.
Ann from Aloha, Oregon.
Yes, Ann.
I listen to your program and I enjoy it very much every night.
Thank you.
And I was wondering if Mr. Green could tell me if he knows anything about or where I could get information about the downwinders. And was wondering if things like allergies and asthma is a result of that.
I'm not sure about downwinders, but on my list of books that you're absolutely, totally crazy if you don't read, is one by Dr. Albert Coca called The Pulse Test. And this is a very simple test that will tell you what you're allergic to. It's far more sensitive than the scratch test.
Really?
And it's very simple. All you do is measure your pulse and find out what your resting pulse is, and then either sniff or taste, you know, some food that you might be allergic to and see what happens to your pulse. And 15 minutes and 30 minutes later, if it's up, then you're allergic to it.
Wow.
And then avoid it.
Say it again.
It's the Pulse Test. It's a $5 book by Dr. Albert Coca, C-O-C-A, and it's put out by one of the major publishers. And it's on my list of books that you're absolutely, totally insane if you don't read.
Great. Sounds wonderful.
All right. I guess we...
Give my address again.
All right. Wayne's address is Wayne Green. Actually, here it says 70 North 202. What does that mean?
That's Route 202.
Oh, I see.
And I have a building called 70 North 202.
So it doesn't, that doesn't have to be there, though. Wayne Green.
No, gosh.
Peterborough, New Hampshire, zip code 03458.
Right.
And the two 800 numbers that are relevant, the easy one to remember is 1-800-274-7373, and the other is 1-800-677-8838.
Right, those are 9 to 5 numbers, Eastern Time.
Eastern Time.
And
so actually,
you'll get Christine probably.
Actually, they're open now.
They are?
Well, they better be. It's after 6 o'clock Eastern Time.
No, I said 9
to 5. Oh, 9 o'clock. 9 o'clock. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
All right. So, a few hours, folks.
Christine isn't even awake yet.
All right. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Wayne Green. Hi.
Hi, Art. First, a couple of comments about one of your sponsors.
Yes.
That little company there in Fortuna, California.
Sea Crane.
Right. I grew up in Eureka, which is about 30 miles from there.
Yes, sir.
And first time home in 14 years was Christmas time. And I took a trip down there, walked into their showroom, and bought one of those crank-up radios.
Oh, the Beijing, sure.
Yes. Okay. It outperforms my radios that, you know, the normal plug-in radios here at the house.
I know.
I'm getting radio stations.
I know. It's amazing.
Yeah. So, anyway, I went ahead and bought a AC adapter for it.
Okay.
And it works great for me. Second of all, I want to ask Wayne what he thinks about this couple that recorded this political phone call.
Yeah,
and should this couple, since they broke a half a dozen federal and state regulations, should they be arrested and prosecuted?
All right. The cellular reception of Newt Gingrich and Company.
Well, there's more than a small question as to whether it was this couple or whether this was a more organized effort than that.
Uh-huh.
So I think we're going to get into the next some deep waters with that. But on the surface of it, yes, it was illegal, and they should get in trouble for it. But, you know, who's going to do it?
One thing I'm rather surprised about, in most of the larger metropolitan areas, or many of them, cellular has for some time now been digitized, is not analog, which means people cannot easily pick it up. You would think back in the Beltway area in Washington, which is where I think this occurred, wouldn't it be digital by now, Wayne?
Well, that's not going to stop anybody that has a knowledge of security.
Well, that's true.
And as a matter of fact, I got a letter the other day from one of the top people in security in the country, thanking me for pushing him into going into his own business.
Yeah, but I mean, they were talking about just a regular scanner. They had received it on a regular scanner. Oh, wait.
Sure.
Hold on. We'll be right back.
Sure.
Wayne Green is my guest. I'm Art Bell. Stay right there. This is CBC.
On the wild card line at 702-727-1295. That's 702-727-1295. First time callers can reach our bell at 702-727-1222. 702-727-1222. Now, here again, Art Bell.
Ah, good morning. Wayne Green is my guest all the way from New Hampshire where the sun is probably getting ready to come up. Must be getting kind of gray out there. Brightening a little bit. He'll be here for another half hour. you have a question, come now. You really want to know about the decline of the American dollar, take a quick trip to Tokyo. Or if that's not enough for you, try flying to Paris. And you see how great your American dollar. I was so glad to get back to the U.S. where a dollar still relatively spends like a dollar. I hope that holds up. Wayne, are you still there?
Pretty much.
Relatively holding up. like the dollar.
Yeah, I've seen a tremendous change in the dollar, since I started traveling.
Oh, it's frightening. It really is. I went to Tokyo at the airport.
Yeah.
And I forget. I think we got a couple of beers and a couple of Cokes. And it was like $30 Americans.
Well, for many years, it was 360 yen to the dollar.
Yeah, I remember those days. I lived there during those days.
Right.
Sad. When I was there, it was like 78 or 79 yen to the buck. Oh, it was awful. It's improved a little since then. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Wayne Green. Hello.
Hello, this is Tony in Oklahoma City.
How you doing?
Just fine. I had a question for Mr. Green about putting out a newsletter.
All right.
And speaking of dollars, I'm an expert in the field of electrical sign repair, and I was thinking about putting something out to that effect and generating some revenue. Is it reasonable to ask for a moderate price on these newsletters, or do you have to get advertisers first?
You want to get the subscribers first. And, yes, it depends on how much it's worth to your readers.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you can make it so that it pays for itself many times over, it hardly makes any difference what you charge.
Okay, well, I was just curious, to make it a monthly kind of thing and generate income immediately with it.
Right. Well, the problem that you have there is, where do you get a list of people that are potential subscribers?
Well, there are several trade magazines, and that would be the first place to start, I guess.
Well, will they sell you their list?
That's possible. It's worth looking into. I just kind of had an idea on that on my way in tonight.
All right. Well, you're a good guy. You answer your own questions. But that is right. And you can approach some companies that will sell you a list, right?
Oh, yes. Many magazines will sell you a list of their subscribers.
All right. First time caller line, you're on the air with Wayne Green. Good morning, actually.
Good morning.
Yes, sir. Where are you?
Riverside.
All right.
California.
Yes, sir.
I have a question for Wayne. Are you familiar with Walsh functions?
No. Okay. What are Walsh functions?
A mathematical equation having to do with Euchemus time.
With what?
Euchemus time.
With what?
I'm not getting it either.
It's the measurement of time, the evenly elapsing time, as defined by Minkowski, Einstein's teacher.
Oh, good grief. Minkowski, right?
Yeah, the arrow of time, defined by Minkowski, who was Albert Einstein's teacher.
Right.
Together they formed the theory of relativity.
Yeah. No, I'm not. That is not in my field of expertise. And
it would
probably,
be a very,
and
very
probably won't be.
All right, we'll look into it when we get an expert on time.
What you want to do is read Galilean magazine. They cover that kind of thing very well.
I am fascinated by the whole subject of time, Wayne, and it's very elusive. I've thought many times time really is man's invention.
Well, it is difficult for us because we're so immersed in it that we believe in it.
Yes.
And, when we see signs that time is not immutable, we reject them. But then remember that all of the fuss that there was when they tried to, when somebody came along and tried to tell us that the Earth was spinning instead of the sun going around us.
That's right.
Because anybody can see that the sun comes up and goes down.
Wildcard line, you're on the air with Wayne Green. Hi.
Mr. Bell and Mr. Green, this is truly probably the best show that I've ever heard.
Glad you're enjoying it.
Well, bless your heart. I could listen to that all day. It's absolutely fantastic. When I was a small child, about 8 years of age, my father bought me a Cub Scout rocket radio. And it was crystal controlled. You pulled the nose cone out to tune in different frequencies.
I remember. I had one of those.
Yeah, absolutely great.
I used to listen to a radio program called The Nightcaps.
Oh, yes.
In Salt Lake.
That's right.
And
KSL up in Salt Lake.
Yeah, KSL and Herb Jeffco.
That's right.
Is the host.
He passed away not long ago.
Oh, did he really?
Yes.
Oh, that's too bad. I'm sorry to hear that. But at any rate, my question is this. Also being fascinated by time, I'm a self-taught watchmaker. And in listening to the program tonight, I've managed to rebuild a beautiful Hamilton pocket watch.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the thing that I was going to ask Art earlier is, how can we influence our children to bring back the old-world craftsmanship that we used to have in this country? The tools that I have to use in my trade were all built in the 20s, the 30s, and the 40s. And it's impossible to buy new watchmaking tools. And the beauty of these watches is fantastic.
Well, he makes such a good point. It relates to electronics as well. Where the hell do you get parts anymore?
It is difficult. And this is a function of our not interesting youngsters in new things like and things like this. In my discussions with the Sudbury Valley School, I made up a list of skills that I thought that they should encourage, not force, but say, hey, kids, here are the benefits of learning these skills. And certainly watchmaking is one. I've had a lot of fun with that. I used to import, well, I had a watch company, Henhart, over in Germany, make watches specially for me for automobile rally use. And I had to learn to fix those and to time them and so forth. So I had a lot of fun with that, and I know what you're talking about as far as the tools are concerned. If we can get kids interested in these, we will have suppliers. We will have new tools. We will have new instruments. But we have to get the kids interested. And, you know, I just went down and made a quick list of the things that I think kids should at least have the ability to learn while they're in school.
Mm-hmm.
And just in the A's, starting with archery, art, the composition, art drawing, art famous paintings, backgammon, baseball, bicycling, bird watching, bookkeeping, bowling, boxing, car repair, and so forth. And I'll eventually have this list in one of my booklets.
All right, I wanted to ask you, we didn't come back to it, I forgot to. You were talking about a scooter with a magnetic mechanism. And
right.
I wanted to know more about that. What was this scooter you rode on it? What was it able to do?
I have a Yamaha scooter of my own, and it's a good, powerful one. It'll go, 60 miles an hour, no strain.
Right.
I got on this scooter, and it's a smaller one over there in London. It had a little tiny battery for getting it started, and that sucker would take me up hills as fast as I wanted to go. I couldn't believe the power that it had.
Using what?
Using a magnetic motor.
A magnetic motor.
Right.
No internal combustion?
No internal combustion.
And now, that's hard to believe.
Exactly. And that's why I haven't done much about it, because I don't believe it, even though I did it. I don't understand it.
Well,
but then I don't know about magnetism, and I know I don't understand. So I don't know what's going on.
But going up hills?
Yes. And going up vigorously. And, of course, all those confounded drivers over there on the wrong side of the road.
Yeah, I know. I know. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Wayne Green. Hi.
Hi, Art. Hi, Wayne.
This
is TJ from Canyon Country.
Yes, sir.
And I had a question regarding health. In the 50s, I know the U.S. government did a experiment in Battle Creek, Michigan regarding fertilization of the water. And then I recently read a newspaper article in the Times saying that it was one of the best U.S. programs because it turned out to be perfectly safe. But I keep hearing people saying that fertilization leads to cancer. And so I was wondering what you felt on that. Or had any...
I didn't get the word. What is it? Fertilization or
fluoridization?
Fluoride in the water.
Oh, fluoride.
Yeah.
Oh, you want to read one of the books on my list of books? You're crazy if you don't read about fluoride. You really want to read that. It's by an author called Yamo Mianis, Fluoride, the Aging Factor. And that'll give you the skinny on fluoride, and you will do everything in your power to keep from drinking it from then on.
Mm.
I distill all my water before I drink it.
You know, returning just for a second to the subject of aging and time, we are so constantly aware of the passage of time. We chronicle it so carefully, literally, by the hour, by the day, by the week, month, and year, that I wonder if we were not chronicling time, whether our lifespans would be as they are now. It may seem a silly question, but are we not ticking off our own remaining hours and minutes and in that way making them real? That's a very esoteric question.
Well, it's it comes down to the sun comes up and goes down every day, and there's no way to avoid being aware of the passage of time.
That is true. First time.
And no matter how we split it up.
First time caller line, you're on the air with Wayne Green. Hi. Hello there. Going once, going twice, gone. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Wayne Green. Good morning.
Hi, Art. I had an answer to that question.
I don't know what question you're referring to. Turn your radio off, please.
The other day about...
Turn your radio off, please.
About the person that weighed the body, and then they weighed it later.
No, it was a scientific experiment in which the body was weighed at the moment of death and lost 3 ounces.
Yeah, it was either a doctor or a Father McDougall.
Was
it? About 12 or 13, about the turn of the century.
I would very much like more information on that. So
I've read about that, too.
Have you?
But that is not in one of the books I recommend.
I see. In other words...
they've been trying to find out about the soul for a long time.
That's right.
And we know pretty well that there is such a thing, but we have it is against the rules to investigate consciousness.
Well, that's somebody else's rules, not mine. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Wayne Green. Where are you, please?
I'm in San Diego. This is a great show. I just have a really simple question. How do you distill water?
Oh, I buy a still from Daymark for under $200. And
yep.
It evaporates, it boils the water and then condenses the steam.
Okay, that's simple.
Yep.
Free plug for Daymark. There you go.
Right.
Thank you.
Well, I got put onto that by Flanagan. So,
who's Flanagan?
Pat Flanagan, the fellow that invented the Neurophone.
Oh, yes.
Right,
okay,
and spent his nuptial night in the Great Pyramid. By the way, there's some wonderful books on the pyramids lately. One by von Daniken is remarkable. I think it's going to make my list on the Eyes of the Sphinx.
I'm going to the pyramids in October.
Oh, for goodness sakes, read the von Daniken book and read the Graham Hancock book on the Sphinx.
Oh, I have. I've had Graham on as a guest several times.
But have you read the book?
Yes, sir, I have.
Okay, isn't it great?
Yes, and it's a lifelong thing I've wanted to do.
Imagine finding out that the pyramid is made of concrete blocks instead of rock.
Yes. Yes, imagine.
And so forth.
First time caller line. I'm sorry, Wayne.
We're
so short on time. You're on the air with Wayne Green. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for having me on. Thanks for having Wayne on.
Sure. Where are you?
I'm in Vancouver, B.C.
Yes, sir.
Great place. It's beautiful up here. A couple quick points. Lahovsky multiple wave oscillator, is that
mm-hmm.
Well for you?
Yeah.
I'm familiar with it. Is it something to follow through and do some...
No, we need to know more about it. I do not trust much that I've read about it yet.
Well, I have plans for it.
Mm-hmm. It's not hard to make.
Yeah.
So I'll be interested in finding out more real data on it.
Okay, and one other point I want
to... And a rife machine also.
Uh-huh. I want to pointing at your 800 number, but one of the other things that occurred to me was rejection of organs when they do a heart or kidney transplant.
You need to read the book on my list called The Secret Life of Your Cells.
Well,
and in there,
my idea is that it's not resonating to the personality.
Well, what they point out there is they take some scrapings from a person, put it in a petri dish, and put a meter on it, and then put a meter on the person. And even though that person is 1,000 miles away, those two meters work in tandem.
Wow.
And this helps explain phantom memories that people have that have transplant organs and even blood donations.
Really? That is incredible.
Well, it's on my list.
There are so many things.
That's why it's on my list.
We don't understand. So many things we don't understand. All right. Your list is available free of charge, right?
No, it's $5.
It's $5. What
is
it?
That gives me the money to buy more books to put on the list.
All right. There is one thing that's available free, and I forget what it is.
And that's a list of my stuff.
A list of your stuff. I'm getting
a 12-page list of the different booklets that I have and why you should read them and so forth.
All right, so that might be a first step.
That's the first step.
And then your list of books that you're insane and mad and all that if you don't read is $5.
Right.
And there are various other things, but you might want to begin with the master list.
Right. And I'm working on more. I had a book out called We the People Hereby Declare War on Our Lousy Government. And I ran out of that, so I'm kind of redoing, updating it a little bit.
See?
But in there I come up with, for instance, a reason why we should increase our foreign aid substantially, maybe 5 or 10 times what we are now, and make an enormous profit on it. And I point out a very simple way that any government bureaucracy, any government bureau, can be cut in half in 3 years and have it done with complete 100% cooperation of all the people involved and happily done.
Well,
How about that? That
sounds like the subject for another program. In the meantime, one more time, so they can't say we have not done it, mm-hmm. If they want to write to you, and a lot of people will write, they simply send something to Wayne Green, Peterborough, New Hampshire, zip code 03458, that's zip code 03458, or call one of the two following 800 numbers beginning at 9 o'clock Eastern Time, 1-800-274-7373, or 1-800-677-8838. That's 1-800-677-8838. Is that about right?
That'll do it.
All right, my friend. Not goodbye, but until next time.
Let's do it again.
All right, Wayne.
And we haven't even scratched the surface, all right?
I know. Thank you, my friend. And good night.
Thank you.
That's Wayne Green. If you would like a copy of this program, it is a 5-hour program, obviously. Packed full of information. You can get it by calling, beginning now, 1-800-917-4278. That's 1-800-917-4278. A lot of information in this program. So, one more time, to get a copy of this program, the Wayne Green program, call 1-800-917-4278. That's it, folks. We've got to go. Hope you enjoyed it. See you tomorrow night at about the same time, same station, and all that. So, good night, Cosmos.